Hey everybody, once again, you're listening to the Potter Pensive Podcast, almost live episode for the holidays. I'm really sorry about that. I'm going to just start off by making an apology. It's great to be podcasting again, but unfortunately we couldn't do our live show as intended just because we ran into some technical difficulties, didn't we, guys?
We did.
At least three of them.
Yeah, at least three. Yeah.
30, maybe.
Yeah, 45.
Couple few.
Yeah. That's it.
So, yeah, real apologies for that. Other than that, it's great to be back. I'm super stoked to record today. How are you guys all feeling being back in the recording studio here?
Feels good.
I'm so excited.
I am, too.
Awesome. Cool.
I feel a little bit nervous, actually. I feel a little rusty.
A little rusty, yeah. Hey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We start recording, and it's sort of all coming back to me now, but, you know, I'm still going to have to... We're still going to have to get used to kind of how we do this or how we record this, so... We will. So we've got Heather, Sarah, Holly, and myself in the studio for this season.
I want to say something about that. You always say we have them in the studio.
Studio!
We don't have a studio.
We don't have a studio. We do have... We have a...
we have them all in our separate rooms.
The big
room. In our separate countries.
We have a figurative studio.
I'm sick of the lies.
Actually, Heather, now that you are coming clean, I think it's more interesting that we are all in different, well, not all in different countries, but almost, and we should play that up more.
I think so, too.
We should. All right. Okay, so what should we change this to,
then? New York and Florida are basically different countries.
Pretty much,
yes. Yes, Florida is in and of itself, and so is New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So should we say that instead of the studio, I guess we could say, like, okay, we are now...
In the metaphysical space where we all combine.
Oh, that's an amazing explanation.
So we're back. So we're back in the medical in the metaphysical, the metaphysical space where we all combine. Sorry, Chio could not be here. We're gonna play an audio clip from him in just a few moments here. But I just kind of wanted to catch up on how we've all been doing the past couple years. Mm. So, Sarah, how have you been doing? Let's start off with you.
I'm married.
You're married!
Yay.
Congratulations!
I can't remember if I was married from the last one, but if you guys already knew that, hey, act like it's new.
I think you got married right after we finished.
Oh, okay.
When did you get married? I feel like you should remember that.
It was April of 2014, but I don't remember our last podcast.
I do. It was around January. This time. Right. It was.
It was January
2014.
Yes.
Oh, February.
Okay, so
no,
I wasn't
no, it
married
was
yet.
You weren't.
It was
but
early winter.
Right.
I remember that because I remember we did like the last five podcasts in really rapid succession. It was stressing all of us out because we would do like two a week. And I remember at that time, Sarah was prepping for her wedding. So there was all that added stress and I felt so bad.
She handled it quite
well.
Yeah, we got through it.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Well, congratulations. Yeah, how's married life treating you?
Married life is pretty good. Married life is pretty good. Got a house, got a car, got property. You know,
got the old ball and chain.
Yeah, that's what happens.
That's all you need.
That's great. Holly, what about you?
I'm still in Hong Kong. I have a new teaching job. I just started at a new school, which has been great. And we're traveling to Tokyo in a couple of days for the Christmas holidays and just really still enjoying life. It's been really good.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. That's so cool. I still just can't wrap my head around the fact that you're sitting in Hong Kong right now. No, that's
And she's such a world traveler now.
Yeah, well, you're such a globetrotter.
I'm getting there. I think I'm still a novice. There's lots of places I haven't been.
Have you been to Europe?
I spent the summer in Europe. We did France.
Well, you're set.
Yeah, she's not quite a novice. It's like an intermediate or something.
I don't know, guys. That's like three continents.
Yes.
So.
Well, you know, we're still getting our feet wet, but it's been good. We've been
awesome.
Lucky.
That's awesome.
Come visit
Heather.
Me.
Yes, we'll come visit you. Yes, Heather. Poor sick Heather. How are you feeling?
Yeah,
poor Heather.
I'm feeling much better than I was in the past couple days, and even earlier today.
Awesome.
Had some tea, feeling better.
Oh, yummy.
Yeah, Sarah and I are sick for this.
Yeah, we will try not to snot too much.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's fine.
Yeah. But other than that, I've been doing great since we left off. I'm still plugging away at my university. I will be finishing my undergraduate degree in May in history. And
awesome.
From there, hopefully, I will have some, you know, graduate school options or work options. And, you know, just try not to be unemployed. That's the goal.
Amen.
Yes. Amen to that. Oh, man.
And you just finished.
What about you, Adam?
Are
we still on me?
Well, I just wanted you to tell everyone what you just finished wrapping up.
Oh, right. I just finished writing my senior thesis, which is like the capstone thing I had to do to complete my degree in history.
Awesome.
But I still have another semester left, but yes, the thesis is done.
Yay!
Hooray!
And finished at 4:37 in the morning.
Oh, my gosh.
A time you will, I'm sure, never forget.
Exactly.
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
Those are the best times of paper writing, not gonna lie.
Yeah, indeed.
What about me? Well, I mean, life is still pretty much the same from when we finished. I'm still going to SFU, or Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, and I'm still working on getting my communications degree. I feel like I'm prolonging my degree because I've decided to tack on another minor in political science just because, I'm kind of freaking out about my future and like, oh gosh, where will this take me? But ultimately I want to go into journalism. I don't know if I've ever said that on the podcast before, but I want to do journalism. I really have developed a passion for that and for storytelling and I love doing research and I'm a curious person. And so I've just been working at my school's newspaper as the opinions editor for the past year or so. And yeah, I've got about a year left before I actually get my BA, and then hopefully, I will go in for a master's of journalism somewhere in Ontario. I'm thinking of going to Carleton. That's mm-hmm. my top one. I really want to try for that. Either that or Ryerson.
Right.
So one of those two.
My best friend graduated from Ryerson.
For journalism?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Her and her husband. Yeah.
How did she find that?
She loved it. She loved
awesome.
It.
Awesome. Good. So. It was probably pretty intensive, hey?
Yeah, but she's pretty intensive, so.
Okay.
I think it was a good fit. That's a awesome. That's a compliment, by the way.
Yeah. So yeah, that's
with love.
Yeah. So that's
good
but
for you
know what?
Adam.
Amongst all this, I am still a big Harry Potter nerd and I have missed podcasting so much with you guys, so I'm super stoked that we could all get together and look at Beetle the Bard, which is something we haven't looked at yet.
Yes.
And I'm a little sad that Chio couldn't join us.
Yeah.
Yes, quite sad.
But we do have an announcement. Actually, I think we should play Chio's audio clip now.
Yes.
I was going to introduce the big Chio news, but I think Chio introduces it himself.
Chio does introduce the Chio.
So let's let him do it, and then we can praise him afterwards.
Hey guys, what's up? I hope you're all having an awesome time. It's been a long time since we made a podcast, so much has changed since then. For example, I'm getting married, episode 7 is now out, and we got a Black Hermione in theaters, which is kinda awesome. But one thing that hasn't changed is our love for geeking Potter stuff out with you guys. With a new movie coming up, I can't think of a better way to close the year than with this live show. That's why I'm so sorry I won't be able to make it to the recording. But here are some guidelines of how I would react, just so we can all pretend I'm there. I agree with Sarah. I'm impressed by Holly's academic knowledge. I found Adam's comments both funny and interesting, and I completely disagree with whatever Heather is saying. Then, it's like I'm right there. Hope everybody enjoys the show and have a great time. Happy holidays. P.S. No Match is way cooler than Muggle.
That's so great.
That's I don't agree either.
With everything that Chio said, obviously.
What an endearing, such an endearing guy. I miss Chio.
Chio, we miss you. When you hear this, we miss you.
Yes. We want
and
you.
And congratulations to Chio on his upcoming marriage.
Wedding. Yes. Mm.
Woo.
Yes.
Insert congrats.
Applause
congrats.
And cheering here. Yes. And I love how he just kind of like brushed it off. Oh, by the way, I'm getting married.
Married. Episode 7
Yay!
Is coming.
Episode 7.
And yes.
More importantly.
But of course, that's what he would do because he's so humble.
Very humble. Yes. And so Chio's getting married next month. He invited us all to his wedding. I don't think any of us are unfortunately able
to
make it.
None of us can go.
He said he did tell us that he really wanted to live stream it for us or have us on like on Skype to you know, virtually be there when he gets married. So I'm going to really try and make some time. We could set up all the computers and just have his virtual friends sitting in the front row.
Just waving all of us in, like formal attire.
I was just going to say, we all have to dress up and, you know, like we're sitting in the front row.
With glasses of champagne and we'll, like, go buy our own cake at the grocery store.
Why not? I could just, like, put on my old wedding dress. Sarah,
yeah, same here.
Too.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to wear white to a wet to another person's
yeah,
wedding.
That's super rude, isn't it?
Well, not really anymore. It depends on what their colors are, right?
That's right. It's true. It's true. But I do not recommend it.
If the bride is not wearing white, then it doesn't matter.
But anyways, it's great to know that Chio's doing well. It's great to know you guys are all doing well, actually. And I'm super stoked to record today with all of y'all.
Y'all.
And I think what we got... All of y'all. I think what we got in the schedule first up is actually we were going to talk about the Fantastic Beasts trailer.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited.
So I was like, guys, we should watch the, we should analyze the Beasts trailer. And I didn't watch it with the sound yet. Like, I'm the worst Harry Potter fan ever. I watched it on my phone without sound on the subway.
You're just a rusty Harry Potter fan.
I'm just...
You're still a Harry Potter fan. It's just you gotta work out the kinks.
Yeah. So will you guys watch it with me now?
Yes.
Yes, we will.
Yeah. Okay.
I would love to, Holly.
Great.
So excited!
Okay, the first time I watched this, I got all of the Harry Potter feels again.
Yes.
All of the original, like, fandom feels.
Oh my god. I love this WB thing.
Oh.
Yes.
It's like going back to like a home.
I know. It's like
we know all the spells, we know the language, you know?
That definitely looks like a Patronus.
Yes,
like
it does.
When all the light comes together and forms.
Look at that.
Which is good because there's such an emphasis on animals in this movie.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, look at this!
Guys, it is going to be around my birthday. I just want to say that.
Yesterday, a wizard.
Congratulations. Writer J.K. Rowling.
A case full of magical creatures. The sound is bringing back the feeling.
Yes.
And unfortunately, some have escaped.
Good. I hope there's a dragon just all over Brooklyn.
Open?
Just a smidge.
Mr. Scamander! Oh, I love that wand work.
Yes, me too. Oh, look at this!
I love that logo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The dragon tail.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Ooh.
Chilling. Absolutely chilling.
Whose birthday? Heather's?
Mine.
That's what I said, too. Birthday. Yeah, that's what I said. It's going to be in time for our birthday, Heather. I'm the 19th. Heather is the 20th. Right, Heather?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Wow, good remembering.
Congratulations. So I just want to say, like, the logo is amazing, first of all.
It's perfect.
Yes. It's perfect logo.
It sort of reminds me of the new Into the Woods logo.
Oh.
Like, kind of thorny.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
Like, very wild.
And, like, meticulously wild, you know?
Yeah.
It's, like, very detailed.
Mm-hmm. Like, cultivated wilderness.
Cultivated wilderness. Is that an oxymoron?
Yes.
Am I asking you that? It's, like, the most obvious oxymoron in the world.
But just the whole trailer was so good.
It was really good.
It was so nice to finally see. Is it Eddie or Freddie Redmayne? It's Eddie Redmayne.
It's Eddie Redmayne.
Get it together,
very,
Adam.
Very talented actor, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I like him.
Recent roles, he played Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything.
I think he is very talented. I'm a little worried about overexposure because, you know, one actor like just winds up in all the franchises and then everyone gets sick of him. I don't want that to happen to him because, you know, he's a little sweetheart, I think.
I think he is at a high risk for that, though, especially with this franchise that he's in.
We got to see a wizarding, or sorry, an American, what was it?
Wizarding Court of Law.
Wizarding Court, which... yeah, so like Court of Law, which is really cool.
I don't know about you guys, but did you guys get like a sense of Nazi symbolism about the American Wizarding Court with the big banner, red banner with the eagle on it behind her? Which, honestly, it's kind of boring at this point. I'm just kind of sick of the whole, like, Nazi Holocaust, like, symbolism in films. Yeah.
I've been sick of that.
So, but I'm trying to be optimistic. I'm trying to be optimistic.
Yeah. But. Well, I think it's just because with, you know, the role that America is playing on stage right now and what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
All of these World War II themes and feelings and... problems are kind of in resurging again. So I think that's why I think a lot of people feel the same kind of fears that maybe they did back then for similar reasons, I guess. But yeah, in the pop culture, it's definitely just overkill.
So overdone.
It is.
When is this movie?
We're going to be excited. It's the 1920s, but we're going to be excited and optimistic because that was only like a 30-second trailer. We still so much we haven't been shown.
You know what I like?
So we can be critical, but excited.
Yes, I think that's a good way to be. I was worried about the American backdrop because I thought we might lose some of that quintessential
British
Wizarding World feel. You know, like the... Right. But I felt it watching the trailer because I think it's like with the music and... the sound effects, it's very familiar, you know?
Yeah.
It feels...
And I think what's gonna help that a lot when we watch the actual movie is the fact that the main character is British, so, you know, he'll be, you know, he's very distinctly British, and, like, he opens up that, you know, that suitcase he has, and he says, just a smidge, which is,
yeah,
you know,
that was a little...
more of a British term, and, you know, there's gonna be lots of British-isms, you know, in and throughout this movie, so I think... That's gonna try, and it's gonna be a trilogy, I think. So
yeah, I think
I don't
too.
Know if we don't know if the other two movies are actually gonna be taking place in the States yet. So.
God, will Harry Potter ever end?
No,
no,
no. It won't.
But we thought it was over, and then bam, it just exploded.
Yeah, and what I thought was so funny is that J.K. Rowling said she would never write about Harry Potter again or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, Sarah has sent us a message, and she has to do a restart on her computer, so she'll just be joining us in a few minutes from now. But in the meantime, let's talk about the casting decision for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Mm-hmm. So they've cast the roles to play Harry, Ron, and Hermione for this two-part play, which I don't... When is it going to be actually performed?
I don't know.
2017, I think.
2017.
Oh, that far away.
Really?
Does that sound right? Plays take a while.
Yeah.
A West End production, yeah, it might.
Where is it? So it's opening in London, and is it coming to New York, or is there talk of that yet, or is it just in London?
I don't know.
Probably will eventually if it has a good run.
Right.
I imagine I think it already does have a good run. I think
even if it's panned by critics, I think that like most people, it would still have a large audience.
Well, the fandom is so vast,
and you know, it's the money that makes the box office go, not necessarily the artistic reviews. So. Right.
Yeah, and like, there's no way. Let's be honest. There's no way it's not going to come to America at some point. Like, it's a big play.
Sometimes,
they've been hyping this up for a really long time.
And sometimes...
I really don't think...
American... Yeah. Sorry, I totally interrupted you.
No, totally. Go for it.
I was just going to say, sometimes American fans can be a lot more enthusiastic than...
Yes.
Their British counterparts about things like this.
True.
So. Yes, I agree. Mm. But so they've casted the roles for Harry, Ron, and Hermione. Mm. So, you know, adult parent Harry, Ron, and Hermione... And they have made Hermione a woman of color.
Yes.
Ooh, black Hermione.
And I think that is fantastic. I think that is so cool. I think that is such a good thing. And I can't believe that there's actually... Well, I mean, like, I can believe it. It's really unfortunate. But yeah, of course it's going to get some controversy from people in the fandom. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we've got this image of Hermione ingrained in our heads as being Caucasian.
But it never says that in the books. It just...
Exactly.
It does is describe her as, like, brown eyes, brown frizzy hair.
Exactly. It never describes what ethnicity she is in the series. And that's something that I legitimately just really thought about yesterday when I read the news. I thought, wow, like, I just took for granted that she was Caucasian. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great, great decision to make Hermione a black woman. I think it's great.
Me too, because of who Hermione is, like, as a character, this, like, very smart, brave, dedicated, like, she's just a fantastic character. And so I think that it's, like, wonderful that a little, like, you know, black girls can grow up seeing Hermione as someone who looks like them.
Yes, and like, yeah. I think, too, I mean, with Shonda Rhimes and all of her TV shows and increasing number of books coming out with young black heroines, and it's kind of like the wave is strong and high, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally. It's the perfect time for it. And I'll admit, when I first heard, I was like, I don't know if I can imagine, you know, because like you said, we have this image of a white Hermione in our minds. But yeah. I think it's so important and exciting to challenge those things that we kind of get comfortable with or hang on to, because mm-hmm. otherwise negative things perpetuate, you know? So it's important to, even if we say to ourselves, oh, I can't imagine that, you know, I don't know how's that going to play out on the stage? Well, good. Right. You know, that's the point. The point is to challenge our ideas of what we think should or shouldn't mm-hmm. be. And I think people are people were miffed about it. Of course, it's a matter of race. And of course, mm-hmm. When people say, you know, it's not about race, it is.
Yeah, it always is.
It always is. But I think people not realizing that they're being ignorant, they would say, oh, but that's just not what I imagined or what I'm used to. Well, then that's the mm-hmm. point, you know, and it's important mm-hmm.
exactly.
to do that, especially for female roles. It's
yeah.
It's the time yeah. to do it. So I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And
great.
I think
great decision.
If I remember correctly, the only time that J.K. Rowling ever mentions race outright in the seven books is when she says that Dean Thomas and Angelina Johnson are black. And I think that's the only time that she ever actually yeah. says anything about it. So
yeah.
You know.
And
there's nothing in the books that says Hermione has to be white. And in fact, a lot of people I know imagine Harry Potter as being Indian.
Really?
Yeah, that's a very, very popular fan representation in the fan art worlds.
Why is that?
There are a lot of reasons, like, because, again, it's never said what his race is, but we do know that he has, like, you know, dark hair.
Because of his physical description.
Yeah, because of his physical description, and also because of how the Dursleys treat him, it, like... Mm. It would make a lot of sense if the hatred that the Dursleys had for Harry was based on race, as well as Petunia and Vernon's dislike for James being out of racism as well.
Hmm.
Wow. That is really interesting.
Yeah, I've never heard that discussion before or read anything on it.
You guys should look into it some more, because like, I'm not Indian, so I don't know as much about it, mm-hmm. About Indian culture, as somebody who imagines... someone who's Indian and imagines Harry Potter as Indian would. Mm. So you guys should definitely take a look into that.
Yeah.
If you'd like to.
Yeah, totally.
There's a whole world of like reinterpretations of characters out there. And I think it's wonderful.
No, I love that. I love that J.K. Rowling has done that, how she's, you know, described hair colors and eye colors, but she has not described what skin color is at all. For most of her characters, except Heather, like you said, those two, like Dean Thomas and who was the other one?
Angelina Johnson.
Angelina Johnson. I love that. I love that these books have the ability to, you know, traverse multiple cultures and countries and have, you know, children imagine themselves in these books. I think that's really fantastic of an author. And I wonder if she did that on purpose.
Oh, well, of course she did. And I think it's just it's a true representation of Great Britain. It's like there's so much diversity in the UK.
Lots of, oh God, yeah.
And it's just, if she didn't do it, then it would be kind of scandalous, wouldn't it? Or it would be
very insensitive, maybe.
Well, yeah, and she's
kind of ignorant.
We know what kind of person she is, and she just wants to truly represent something and honor things that deserve to be honored.
Absolutely.
So, oh, by the way, Lee Jordan is black in the films, but in the book, is there any mention of his, or any, like,
oh, I think he is mentioned as that. Yeah.
Is he? Okay.
I think he is mentioned as black.
Okay. Anyway, cool.
All right. So let's dig into The Tales of Beedle the Bard by J.K. Rowling. When I first bought this book, I kind of skimmed through it, but I think, like, last night was the first time that I actually really read through it and really paid attention to every single little detail of this book. I feel really bad saying that. Oof. Well, Harry Potter amateur. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was super informative, and just it really enriched the Harry Potter universe. And I love how the front page, first of all, says translated from the original runes by Hermione Granger.
Yeah.
Oh,
so nostalgic.
It. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. So good. Okay, so we're going to go through the introduction, first of all. So I know we've divided up the parts, so I guess I'll just quickly go over my part here. So the beginning of the introduction, it talks about, or J.K. Rowling, she talks about how in Muggle tales, typically, magic is used by the antagonist, or is used to kind of facilitate the protagonist's troubles. Whereas the tales, you know, fairy tales in the wizarding world, both, you know, the good guys and the bad guys use magic. And
right. Well, it's like for Muggles, we just learn how to live our lives and you know, an ethically sound way. Just we learn how to have strong, good morals, you know, but for magical people, you just tack on the magic part, how to use magic in an ethical way.
That's right.
And that's all.
It's interesting to note the original role of fairy tales, in our Muggle world. They're, supposed to be like a means, for children to understand things that occur in their own world through like metaphors and symbolism and such. So like the whole idea of like, don't go into the woods alone, like the woods are bad, that's where all the bad things happen, that's supposed to like protect the youth and like encourage them as they grow older to stay within those bounds of like the village, where there's safety and that's where your family is, and so like you should avoid the dangers of the world in the woods, or like avoid the witch, because, you know, during, like, early modern Europe, it was, you know, a witch was any woman who lived alone on, like, the edge of the town in a cottage, and would often, be basically a midwife, and so you were taught to avoid her, because she was, you know, helping women, and can't have that.
Helping women live their lives in a healthy, safe way.
Exactly. So obviously that's magic, and obviously that's evil.
Right.
And so that's
the
goal of these fairy tales originally that like we're familiar with, like Hansel and Gretel or Little Red Riding Hood. And so it's interesting to see pretty much the same thing that J.K. Rowling decided to include for her understanding of wizarding fairy tales.
Yeah, I think it just transfers over with added meaning, you know, in the sense that you have this extra power, and this is how you should go about using it. And another thing I'll add to your insight, Heather, is just, you know, it's fairy tales are also used to teach adults, don't go into the darkness, meaning make a choice to reject your own darkness within yourself. Mm-hmm. So teach your children properly, and then practice those things yourself within yourself.
Yes.
The next portion in the introduction, sorry, are we reading these still?
I think I would like to hear.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go for it. Yeah. I didn't read my part, but maybe I should have. Sorry
about failed.
That. I failed.
No, you were great. You were good.
So Rowling writes again in the introduction that another noble difference between these fables and their Muggle counterparts is that Beedle's witches are much more active in seeking their fortunes than our fairy tale heroines. Asha, Altheda, Amada, and Babbity Rabbity are all witches who take their fate in their own hands, rather than taking a prolonged nap or waiting for someone to return a lost shoe. The exception to this rule, the unnamed maiden of the warlock's hairy heart, acts more like our idea of storybook princesses, but there is no happily ever after at the end of her tale. Mm. And, well, that's true to some extent. It's, like, the fairy tales that Rowling is referring to here is showing, like, weak women are the ones that have been packaged for us over the time. Like, Disney, yes. like, wrapping them up in a tight little bow and, like, cutting the corners and so that the heroines are just, like, meek and, like, do their, like, stick to what they should and, if they do something wrong, they're immediately punished. But that's not really the actuality of, female characters in the original fairy tales. Like, they're not just weak and, like, just taking a nap or losing a shoe. Like, Little Red Riding Hood took an axe and cut the wolf open and, like, got her grandmother out from the wolf's stomach. So
right.
I don't...
That's right.
Of course.
That's like, pretty badass.
So that shows how our imaginings of fairy tales have changed over the time because, like, we are only receiving them through, like, other people's interpretations, the ones that we get now.
Right.
Right.
And, like, you can kind of, I know we'll talk about this a little bit later, but, like, I remember reading in this book about, you know, Beatrix Bloxham's toadstool
yes.
tales mm-hmm. and how she would take some of these really gruesome themes and just, like, reinvent them to preserve children's innocence.
Exactly. They've been Disneyfied.
And, yeah, exactly.
They've been Disneyfied, yes.
Yeah, Disneyfied.
I think that these would, I was telling Heather a few days ago, we were talking about this, a lot of the Beatle tales, I guess maybe they would honor Angela Carter's feminist take on fairy tales, how she mm-hmm. retold Red Riding Hood. She did Cinderella,
mm-hmm.
and she did a few others. I think Snow White. Anyway, listeners, correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I have to go back and do the research, but her fairy tales are these feminist, empowering, dark and dirty tales mm-hmm. about female heroines and by rebelling and thinking for themselves and taking matters into their own hands, they save their own life or they get what's theirs. You know,
that's awesome.
Unabashedly and just kind of unapologetically. So yeah,
that's awesome. That's wonderful. And like.
Yeah.
I just want to speak to the author's role here. So we know that J.K. Rowling is, you know, very prominent human rights activist, and she's always raising awareness through, like, social media about, you know, social issues, and she's always donating money to various charities. And, like, when I read this paragraph that Heather just wrote out, I thought, like, this is so perfect. Such a thing that Jo would write mm-hmm. for a book like this. Just mm-hmm. gotta, you know... Mm-hmm. She really makes the Wizarding World, in a sense, you know, fairy tales wise, to be like what the Muggle world should be.
Yeah, know? And I mean,
love that. I love how she's just sort of created that world and transformed it, and has shown us that this is how we should be. In essence, that's what she's trying to say.
She's a true humanist and feminist. And remember, like, this was back in 2007, 2008, and of yeah. course, like, feminism. I mean, it's enjoying a huge resurgence thanks to social media. I think. Mm-hmm. mainly, and back then it wasn't where it's at right now.
Yeah, we're on a third wave feminism now.
Right.
So I've heard some argue that we're heading onto the fourth.
And I think this was before the I think feminism was the movement was kind of asleep back then.
Yeah.
Right.
Even though it wasn't that long ago. So what she was writing back then wasn't in the forefront
popular
of everyone's minds. Yes.
Exactly.
Thank you.
It wasn't a popular hegemonic ideal,
that,
I guess.
That's, I mean, it was just asleep or it was,
it was asleep. It was, yeah.
It was buried under a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Still.
Lots Does of other sense? Problems at the time. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's really cool. I think we should maybe go on to Chio's part here. Yeah, so let's listen to Chio's, because Chio took the next paragraph. So we can listen to him talk, and then we'll discuss what he says.
Okay, it's been a while since I last read something on the podcast, but here we go. Peter the Bard lived in the 15th century, and much of his life remains shrouded in mystery. We know that he was born in Yorkshire, and the only surviving woodcut shows that he had an exceptionally luxuriant beard. If his stories accurately reflect his opinions, he rather liked muggles, whom he regarded as ignorant rather than malevolent. He mistreated mistrusted dark magic, and he believed that the worst excesses of wizard kind sprang from the all too human traits of cruelty, apathy, or arrogant misapplication of their own talents. The heroes and heroines who triumph in his stories are not those with the most powerful magic, but rather those who demonstrate the most kindness, common sense, and ingenuity. How was that?
Oh, did you guys get the little "how was that" at the end of
this
recording? That was great, Gio. You did well.
Way to go. I would like to state for the record that I chose him to read that because of the luxuriant beard. Because we all know he has a luxuriant beard awesome. As well.
Excellent choice. Yes. Excellent decision-making parameters.
I mean, good. You know, deep thoughts.
You made a very well-thought-out decision there.
I know, right?
Very proud of you.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about what he said. So he says, the heroes and heroines who triumph in his stories are... not those with the most powerful magic, but rather those who demonstrate the most kindness, common sense, and ingenuity.
I think that's true. At least from the story that I read. Well. That's definitely it. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I guess, like, I kind of want to apply that to, like the story that I'm going to take, which is the Warlock's Harry Hard. I guess we could get there when we get there, but that story doesn't have a happy ending, and I don't really see there being any hero or heroine in that story at all. Or maybe there is, it's just...
I think it's the lesson is the hero of the story.
Is the hero. Yeah. I mean, we can talk about it more when we get there, but
you know,
I just...
maybe Warlock's Harry Hart is not actually a traditional fairy tale, but it was something added in, like, the mid-19th century during, like, the Gothic literature phase.
Ooh.
And then so everyone just assumes that it's all old-timey, but it's really only... It was only added in the 1800s.
Girl, you're on a roll.
The telltale Harry Hart.
The telltale Harry Hart.
Yeah, that's a little Edgar Allan Poe joke for you.
I'll have to do some research on that later.
I like how Chio said that he read the part that says if his stories accurately reflect his opinions, he rather liked Muggles, whom he regarded as ignorant rather than. I can't even say this word now.
Malevolent.
It's a malevolent.
it's a tongue full. It's hard to say. He pulled it off though.
No, he did.
Yeah. I was just going to say, those comments, you think like, oh, those are just everyday things, you know, like that applies to Muggles, but not really, because I think to be a good wizard or witch, you have to have a lot of common sense. And then he said ingenuity, which I think strictly sort of applies to witches and wizards as far as everyday life goes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, use your magic with ingenuity and common sense, and otherwise, you know, you're a dumbass. And I guess it's just saying, like, you know, Beetle wasn't cantankerous. He wasn't a jerk. He was a nice guy. So, yeah, it just says that Dumbledore would agree with Beetle's view on Muggles. You know, they're ignorant. That gives them a sort of innocence. They're benevolent. They're just kind of, they're in the dark about it all, you know? So he says, or sorry, the text goes on to say that Dumbledore would agree with Beetle's view on Muggles and how we should view them, how they should be treated. And this similarity of outlook notwithstanding, it was a surprise to discover a set of notes on the tales of Beetle the Bard among many papers that Dumbledore left in his will to the Hogwarts archives. How exciting, right? Not including the books that he covertly left for Hermione. This commentary was written for his own satisfaction, which I'm sure it was, or for future publication, we shall never know. I'd say both. Of course he wants everyone to gain further insight into these tales, We've been graciously granted permission by Professor Minerva McGonagall, now headmistress of Hogwarts, to print Professor Dumbledore's notes here alongside a brand new translation of the tales by Hermione Granger. So when,
oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I think this is so nostalgic. Like, this kind of reminds me of the tone of the epilogue, you know, 19 years later.
Yes.
Because it's very, I think it's kind of indulgent of Rowling to be writing this. You know how she writes everyone's full name. She's kind of restating what these characters are doing currently. And I think it's just sort of a paying homage to the character, her beloved characters. You know, she just
I think that's the way it was throughout most of the book, actually. There was a lot of parts, you know, in the side notes where they would, you know, where, you know, J.K. Rowling would reveal information about characters, or would reveal, like, information about, like, present-day characters, you know, not, like, from the Harry Potter series era or time period, but, you know, kind of, like, what they're doing now. And
just
juicy
bits.
Yeah, little juicy bits. And I feel like part of the book was really to bring us some, I don't know, just kind of what you were describing, just
some insight.
Some insight, I guess. Not just insight, but paying homage to her characters.
Indulge in the nostalgia of it all. Like,
that's right.
Because that's why we want to read Fantastic Beasts. That's why we want to read these little extra books, because we just want more. It's like,
we want more. They're loaded with, like, little information. And some of it's not even really related. I felt like some of it wasn't even really related to, like, some of, like, what was being said. They were just kind of, like, thrown in there to,
little, you know, juicy nuggets.
Indulge the fans.
To indulge us, yes.
Yes, little just informative nuggets.
Indulge our insatiable demands.
I want chicken nuggets.
I always want chicken nuggets. I might get some. Oh, guys, non sequitur. In Hong Kong, you can order McDonald's 24 hours a day.
Wow.
Delivery.
I'm jealous.
Whoa.
I know.
That is so cool.
It's so disgusting and wrong, and it's so convenient and wonderful.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
It is a beautiful thing. Yes. So I'm just going to sum this up. It basically just says we get all these little tidbits. It's insightful. It's reminiscing about the wizarding world, and it enlightens us. It gives us a really strong foundation about the wizarding world and why wizards have certain attitudes and beliefs, and just the history of how things work, like the physics of it all as well. Right. That's Sarah's part. So it is the belief of all who knew him, Dumbledore, personally, that he would have been delighted to lend his support to this project, given that all royalties are to be donated to the Children's High Level Group. Is that an actual charity?
Actual charity.
Yeah.
Right. Which works to benefit children in desperate need of a voice. So that this really, it melds the real life with the wizarding world,
Muggle in the wizarding world.
Of course, it's like, you know, plugging the charity, which is great, but it's also just making everything more real and exciting for us too.
And also, like, it's just highlighting that Dumbledore is willing to help charities in the Muggle world as well as the wizarding world.
I think that it's great that J.K. Rowling decided to write fairy tales of a children's book to support a children's charity.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, it's just, she knew what she was doing.
She really always does.
Yeah. So.
Where's Sarah?
I don't know.
Her computer had to do, like, some major update, and she's only on, like, 20% there.
Aww. Okay, well, can we, Adam, you're going to have to edit this, sorry.
That's okay.
So it gives me great pleasure to talk about The Fountain of Fair Fortune, because this and The Warlock's Hairy Heart happen to be two of my favorite tales.
Oh my goodness.
And I had not read these stories since, you know, like 2009 or something, so it was really great to read them all again. I forgot a ton of stuff. But anyway, so The Fountain of Fair Fortune, I mean, you guys have all read the story.
Love it. It's my favorite too.
Yeah. So basically we start out with saying that in this kingdom far away, which I thought was really interesting because the fact that they set this in a kingdom but don't specify what it is, it sort of like coincides with the Muggle idea in fairy tales of like this mythic past of decentralized monarchy where, you know, it's like there's a government, but it does, it's not really, doesn't really do anything, you know? Right. So I thought that was cool. Another, parallel between the Wizarding and Muggle world. Mm-hmm. But in this kingdom,
yeah, totally.
There's, a fountain on top of a hill, and it's, said that on the longest day of the year, in this garden, the guardian will choose someone, and they will be able to go into the garden and bathe in the, the fountain and receive fair fortune forevermore. Mm-hmm. Hence the name, the Fountain of Fair Fortune. Mm-hmm. So we start off with three main characters, three women, Asha, who is, sick, Altheda, who is poor and, lost her wand, so she's magicless, Amada, who is heartbroken, and all three of these women decide that if one of them is chosen, they'll all go, they'll grab onto each other and help each other up the way, and so that happens. Who is it who's chosen? Asha. Asha was originally chosen, so they grab onto everyone, and they get pulled into the garden, but a knight, Sir Luckless, comes with him, and he's a muggle, he has, no magic power. And he's just, like, a really bad knight. He's, not so great at what he does.
When you were reading this, can I ask you a question? When you were reading this, like, was anybody, reminded of the, third task from the fourth Harry Potter
book? Oh, that's so interesting.
Because, like, that immediately jumped into my mind.
Yeah.
Like, when, you know, especially when it says, like, the what were they in? The garden closed
the garden.
Behind them?
Right, because it was, the vines that came out and grabbed them, and then they're supposed to, like, go to the top
of this
hill and grab, like, you know, a chalice and a fountain, the kind of similar, both, holding a liquid, and there were supposed to only be three of them, but then a fourth one winds up along the way. Oh, you were so right, Adam.
Oh, my gosh, there's so many parallels here! Ah! That is so cool!
I think that maybe the designers of the games, do you think that they, do you think that they fashioned it after this tale?
Because I'm having so many revelations.
Remember, there's a fountain at the very end where Harry meets Voldemort, where he refigures.
That's
right. To life. And yeah.
That's right.
There's a fountain, right? And, am I wrong?
Well, he bathes. No, it's a cauldron, and he bathes in it.
Right.
He's like, the little Voldemort baby is put in the stew, and then he comes out a full-grown Voldemort.
That's so messed up.
Isn't there a fountain in the, maybe I'm not remembering properly, but isn't there a fountain in the actual maze in the third task?
I don't think so.
Or is that something else? Okay.
That's what I was asking. I think in the movie there could be, but maybe I'm just like,
might have been.
I don't know. Anyway,
I think,
there's a lot of similarities.
You know, there are
I think
lots
like
of
a fountain and a goblet
like,
are similar enough that we can,
right?
You know,
yeah. But also, like, just the whole idea of them jumping into obstacles and like creatures that won't let them pass, right? So, like the worm you're going to talk about reminded me of the Sphinx.
That's,
and
next up is they have to face three obstacles. As you know, three is a very important number in fairy tales, both Wizarding and Muggle.
Yes.
Three brothers, three sisters, three obstacles. So the first obstacle that they meet is a white worm, and it demands proof of pain to pass. And so they all try and fight it. They throw stones and spells, and, Luckless breaks his sword on it. But, all this violence that they acted upon the worm, it had no effect on it. It was only, Asha starts to cry, and that is what, it's either satiates or sates, or maybe it's not a word at all,
satiates.
Slacks, whatever, it cures the worm's thirst, which I thought was great, because,
let me look,
it's like, okay,
what page is it on?
Oh, I don't know if the word's in the book, I'm just trying to come up with the right word, anyway, so, like, the violence, has no effect on the worm, like, that, it has to be your own pain, not pain that you act onto another creature that allows them to pass.
Right.
And so they continue on their way until words appear on the ground that say, pay me the proof of your labors. And they try and, like, literally pay with Sir Luckless placing a coin on the ground, but it rolls away. And, I think that's pretty cool because it's basically an anti-capitalist garden saying, no, like, your money that only has the, you know, power to it that we assign, we're going to reject it because we don't hold that your money represents anything of value.
Right.
It's not valuable in and of itself. It's just represents.
Exactly. It's just what we think it has value on. And the garden refuses to play that game, man.
Mm-hmm.
It's all for the worker.
It's sticking it to the man.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Down with Wall Street.
Down.
So they keep walking, but they can't get anywhere until, and Altheda is like, she's sweating and she's like encouraging all the others to go on. she's the one who's poor and without magic, and so she's working really hard at it. And then that sweat, like, seeps into the ground, and then the letters disappear, and they can move on. And I think that it was really interesting that it's Altheda, the witch who has no magic power, who manages to get by this through, like, physically working hard. Because I feel like in the wizarding world, there's a lot of, like hard work is really stigmatized. Like, think of the Weasleys who are poor and they have to work really hard to get anything. Mm-hmm. Or the all of Hufflepuff House, which mm-hmm. is, you know, the house that everyone makes fun of the most. Because they're not afraid of hard work and they're, like, they'll toil for anything. And I think that with magic, this sort of goes back to what we were saying earlier about how magic can't solve all problems. Mm-hmm. Is that magic is sort of seen as this thing that should be able to help you. And then if you're not, like, having the greatest time, and if you have to work hard, that means that you must not be a very good witch or wizard, and therefore you should be, like, like, prejudiced against.
Like, it has currency, whereas hard work should have more currency.
Exactly. See, currency, it's like...
Yeah.
Like, there's definitely, like, a theme of, like, work and payment here.
Mm-hmm.
In this whole little section, which is, like, amazing what you can cram into fairy tales, like, meant for children, but then to, like, have adults understand as well.
It's endless. It's too much if we don't have even enough time to go over
really
it all.
Don't.
Yeah.
and the third obstacle that they have to face is a stream that says, pay me the treasure of your past. I thought that was really interesting because there's a stream in the tales of, the Tale of Three Brothers that we know that they have to pass. But they managed to pass over it with magic, but none of that works here.
Right.
Until Amada gives them her memories of, her past lover that scorned her. And so she's basically acknowledging that that time was in the past, and she's accepting that, she will never have this love again.
She's getting over it, like, literally in the moment.
She gets over it, and then she gets over the river.
Right.
Awesome.
Does anybody see any similarities between this story and the Tale of the Three Brothers?
I really do, because, you know, it's like three sisters.
That's right.
I don't think they're not actually sisters, but, like, they sort of, like, have this sisterhood forged in the garden.
Yeah, and, I mean, they all have, like, their one distinct...
That's why they're at the fountain to begin with, is to sort of get something out of it.
And you know what I love about it? That it flips the whole idea of the white knight on its head.
Yeah.
The sisters save him. Yeah. Or they help him.
Actually, he's a rusty knight at the end. Like, he's not white at all. He's down on his luck.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, some nice feminist witches here.
Right.
Helping the Muggle Knight, which is great.
Yeah. It's kind of doing what Angela Carter does in her fairy tales. It just flips it upside down.
Did she write in the 80s?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. I think 70s, 80s?
Yeah, because that sounds about right. I think there was, during that time period in fantasy writing, there was an emphasis on flipping the narrative around. And, like, traditionally what you're expecting is, like, the farm boy to save the day, but here we have, like, three women,
coming in for him and walking ahead of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, cool. That's a fun continuity.
Also,
also,
I just wanted to mention, like, there's an illustration for this.
I love it.
So I think J.K. Rowling did this.
Did she?
Oh, I think she did,
She did the illustrations for this.
She's such a wonderful illustrator. I love her illustrations.
I know, I always forget that she's, like, a really good, like, artist, too.
She's a good artist, but I'm really intrigued by the Deathly Hallows symbol on the bottom basin there of the...
Look at you.
What?
Fountain.
What?
So, like, what does that mean? Okay, so look at the image of the fountain.
Wait, now, is there more illustration?
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you got the eye in the middle, and then below it you've got the Deathly Hallows symbol.
Oh, and there are runes there, too. I wish I had time to translate them.
Yeah.
There's so, two, three runes, and then there's, like, okay, keep going.
And an eye...
And then there's, like, is that a serpent? Like, the serpent?
Yeah, it's a dragon.
A dragon, right.
Okay,
well,
yeah, this,
like,
is a dragon.
The, what is it called? Like, the Crucius or Crucius is something. It's, like, the symbol for medicine, you know, with, like, around the cross with the snake.
But what does it mean?
Yes.
what does it mean?
What does it all mean?
Is it a healing, like a healing thing? Yeah. Right?
I guess so.
I think it stands for the fountain is kind of like a sort of medicine, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it, well, but then why it? Would they have or the Deathly Hallows symbol on the bottom basin of that fountain there?
Just to F with us.
Just to mess with the fans? That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking it's there just to mess with all of us.
Right. Or because there is a connection between this tale and the three brothers.
Right.
Perhaps.
That's what I was thinking. Or I was thinking the creators of Lost drew this. They would.
Good old J.J. Abrams.
Right.
Messing around with the Harry Potter fandom.
Well, he's allowed. He's a big fan of Harry Potter.
Is he?
Yeah, he is.
Oh my God. I just remember the time that Adam tried to get me to watch Lost like 6 years ago, and I saw.
Oh, I remember that.
I saw like six episodes.
Guys,
it looked like they were having a nice time on the beach.
Yeah, it didn't go so well.
I don't think they were. Have you guys watched The Leftovers?
No.
Oh, no. What? Do it. Just do it. We won't talk about it here, but
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, but we were talking about, before we started talking about Lost, we were, discussing the fountain as, like a symbol of, healing and, but is it actually though? Because, like Asha, the sick one, is not saved by the fountain. She's saved by, again, Althea's hard work and like determination. She finds these plants and gives them to her and is like, well, so Asha doesn't need the fountain anymore because she's been cured. Althea decides she doesn't need the fountain anymore because she has this. She's discovered this skill of hers in healing, which I think is really cool because she says, like, oh, I can earn some money this way, therefore I don't need the fountain. But that doesn't address the fact that she's still wandless and without her magic. So, or, like, in this mythic kingdom, do you think that wands are just, like, really cheap and easy to come by? Or that, she's decided she no longer needs magic because she has, like, the magic of the earth that she can use to her advantage.
The latter. And I,
And
yeah. I guess that's answers our question as to why the Hollows symbol is there, because that's the whole lesson we learn about the Hollows, mm-hmm. is that they're there and they empower us, but we can empower ourselves.
Ourselves. Yeah. Yes, very good.
Good point.
Right?
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So now it's just a model left, but she says that she like doesn't care about her boy anymore because she like when she took out her memories of him, she realized that he was like really mean and awful. So she tells Luckless to just like get in the fountain for like out of thanks for his help along the way.
Right.
So he I think that's really interesting that he's the one who ultimately is chosen to go in the fountain, because he, at the beginning of the story, when he was accidentally taken into the garden and all the women were mad at him, he says, like, listen, I don't want the fountain. I don't want to bathe in it. Like, this is all up to you guys then. So it's, basically the guy who, wasn't thinking of himself when he did this gets to use the fountain, which I thought was kind of like Harry Potter finding the Sorcerer's Stone. Like, only you, who wants to find it but not use it can get it.
Interesting.
That's because he's worthy of it.
Mm-hmm. So he bathes in the fountain, then he gets out, and then he proposes to Mata, and she's like, yeah, let's get married.
all right, let's do this.
And they're all, like, happily walking into the sunset, the four of them arm in arm, and then, like, the last little note is that the fountain isn't magical at all. It's, like, so I think what it is, it's just the tasks that the people have to face on their way up to the fountain. And the challenges along the way changed them into, like, being the people that they needed to be, so that by the time they reach the top, and get to bathe in the fountain, they've already, become what they needed.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
It's a great tale.
So I guess the fountain is a tangible, like, makes the theme tangible. It's like it stands for what we should learn.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, and then Dumbledore's notes on the story, they're just kind of, like, more fun than anything else. They do talk about Lucius Malfoy and how he wanted story banned from the library because...
See, stuff like that, I think that's, you know, kind of going back to what I was talking about, where he just kind of inserts random things that maybe don't quite fit with, you know, what we're talking about, but, like,
well, it's so cool to hear that enriching information. He wanted censorship because
he thought
that it promoted interbreeding between wizards.
That's
and
right.
Muggles.
That's right.
And then Dumbledore's like, "Nah, son."
Well, and then I think it said that that's where that's when that sort of feud between Dumbledore and Lucius started, where Lucius was determined to get Dumbledore out of, you know, Hogwarts, and Hogwarts was determined to... What was the last sentence that was
Dumbledore
really
was determined to remove Lucius from his position as Lord Voldemort's favorite Death Eater.
Yeah, that's right.
Honestly, this, like, the notes section on this is really funny. It talks about the pantomime, the Christmas pantomime that they tried to put on at Hogwarts, and Professor Kettleburn, like, burning down the school.
Right,
I would,
that's
like,
scary.
Just go, I can't do it justice. Go and read it now. Right now.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Indulge yourself.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I actually think that The Fountain of Fair Fortune is one of my favorite tales.
I think it's my favorite.
It's a very popular one.
Yes, it is.
Oh, I don't know. It's a cross between this one and then the one that I've taken, The Warlock's Harry Heart.
Those are my favorite too.
Ooh,
I forget it. I don't really remember. It kind of reminds me of like Beauty and the Beast.
Sort of, in a sense. Kind of. There are those
Maybe just because it says Harry.
Maybe,
yeah. But like there are in Dumbledore's notes at the end of mine, like he does reference beasts, right? Mm. And viciousness and things like that. So yeah, you're onto something there. Okay. What were you saying, Heather?
I was just gonna say take it away.
Take it away.
Oh, take it away. Take it away, Adam. Okay, so I'm gonna start off by saying that I love this fairy tale. I absolutely love it. And it's horrifying. It is a grotesque, brutal, gory story that does not have a happy ending. I don't see there being a hero or a heroine to this story, and then I don't know, I guess we can talk about this a little later, but I guess like the hero is kind of the moral of the story in a way. I don't know, we'll get there, but so I just wanted to quickly ramble off a couple facts about some extra tidbits about this story that I found online. So this The Warlock's Harry Heart is the only story not mentioned in the seventh Harry Potter book, which I find interesting.
Really?
And I think part of that is because maybe a part of it is maybe because there are so many themes in this story that relate with the entire Harry Potter series that it might have been, if they had talked about it or referenced it in the series, it might have been like a little bit too much or a little bit redundant. I don't know. Like, I'm sure
there
are ways.
I just thought she hadn't thought of it yet.
Maybe she hadn't thought of it yet. That's probably what it was.
Because I think she did say that she regretted naming one of her stories Babbity Rabbity and the Cackling Stump. Because, in the time, she thought, oh, that's so funny. Think of a fairy tale named that. And then when she decided to actually write them, she's like, oh, God, what am I supposed to do with this?
Right. Oh, yeah. She did say that kind of recently, too. I love that name. And then I thought the Warlock, she talked about how it would have done Voldemort well to know Warlock.
Yes.
The Harry Heart, so, because of the, yeah, I'm sure you're going to get
that. Yeah. I have the quote here. J.K. Rowling said that, you know, she said, quote, Voldemort would have done well to know this story before he set out on his campaign of terror.
Yes.
Which, like, we'll see in a sec that this is very obviously true, because it basically relates to Horcruxes and immortality, and there's so many themes of vulnerability, and us, even as Muggles, being afraid. We can relate to it because, you know, we're afraid of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I'll just jump right in to start the story off here. Let me just go to my first page here. Okay, so there is basically a warlock who, a very wealthy warlock who does not want to fall in love. He sees love as weakness. He sees all of his peers falling in love and getting married and having children, and he sees that as a hindrance to being a great and powerful wizard or human being. No maiden has ever succeeded in touching his heart, says the story. And when he grows up, it doesn't say at the beginning of the story explicitly that he dabbles in dark arts, but he decides to completely, I guess, shield himself from the vulnerabilities of love and never commit himself to any of those emotions or commit himself to anybody else in particular. And when he sees his peers growing up and marrying, he congratulates himself upon, you know, being wise and, you know, what he sees as being wise and making that early choice. So I find that really interesting. I find this very much in line with Tom Riddle and, you know, even though we're not really dealing with immortality here, we're still talking about vulnerability and, you know, wanting to, you know, distance yourself from vulnerability to make yourself, you know, an all-powerful wizard.
A few shades of the picture of Dorian Gray there as well.
Yeah, that's
like
that too.
You know, doesn't he, like, lock his heart away? And then, like, you know, Dorian Gray, he gets his painting and he locks it away in his attic so that...
That's right.
And the painting grows old and, like, also the marks of all of his sins appear on the painting. So, right. like, his outer flesh, like, he keeps pure and good, whereas the painting will, like, shows all of, like, the evil that he's done.
Oh, wow. I haven't read that.
I just read it this year for class.
Yeah.
Great
connection. So it's still on my mind.
Yeah. Great connection.
In that way, I mean, yeah, I think there are parallels in that sense. Okay, I'll get to that part in just a sec. But the parents die, and he basically reigns alone with his servants in their castle, and, you know, he's sure that everyone must be envious of him and all of his gold and all of his wealth. And then he hears a couple of those ruddy servants expressing pity for him and saying, you know, I can't believe that, you know, he's got all of this money and wealth, but like he doesn't want to take in a wife and all this kind of stuff. And so he resolves to take in, even though he doesn't feel anything for anybody, he resolves to take in a wife that is superior to all other wives. And that day, coincidentally, that day, he finds a fair and beautiful maiden in the village and begins to court her.
What luck!
What luck!
Yeah.
And it says that all the lords have tried to, you know, claim her for their own, but they have not succeeded. And he doesn't feel anything, but he begins to court her and he invites her to dinner. And it says in the story that she, and I feel like this maiden has got a really good intuition, has got some really good intuition, a really good sense of, you know, who people are and, and, you know, kind of what makes them tick. Maybe I'm reading into that way too much, but
she's got some major emotional intelligence happening.
She has got some major emotional intelligence.
It's so funny because J.K. Rowling says that she has, like, no agency in her own story in the introduction.
She has no agency in her own story?
Yeah.
Oh, she says the unnamed.
Like, the maiden is, like, a soppy little, like, weak kind of princess.
Right. Right. Okay. But she's not. She's not, though, because it's it. Well, I don't believe so.
I think
it says
says that she circumstantially, maybe she has no control over.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. Keep going, Adam.
But it says that she's fascinated by him, but she's also repelled by him because she senses there's a darkness there. So she's not just this, you know, weak, submitting woman, right? Like, my handsome prince. Like, she's got, you know, she's her own character. She knows what's up, right?
But so, she does choose to submit, doesn't she?
She does. She does submit to, she submits to peer pressure, and she goes to dinner. And this is what I'd like to call the date from hell. Can I coin that term with respect to this? The date from hell. He invites her to this great feast. I mean, God, this is like the worst date you could ever go on. I'm not even joking. He invites her to this fantastic feast. You know, there's music. There's, you know, he employs her with words of tenderness that he's stolen from poets without any idea of their true meaning. You know, it's a beautiful scene,
That's
but something is wrong.
Bite him in the butt later.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Always cite your sources.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Cite.
Heather knows that
cite
more
your
than
sources,
anyone
folks.
This month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And she outright says that she doesn't think that he has a heart. And he says, well, you know, follow me. Come down to my dungeon.
Yikes.
Come down to my dungeon, baby, and I'll show
you
where my heart is.
Hannibal crap.
Yeah, we've
this
gone
is
from
some
Oscar Wilde to Hannibal.
Right.
Pardon the French, but this is some creepy shit. Like,
yeah.
They're going into the dungeon, and it's just...
Like, I don't know, that's where I always take my dates.
Yeah, I don't know about you guys, but the basement it is.
Down to the dungeons. So he leads her to this chest that he has in his dungeon, and he opens it up, and inside is his heart. And it's a hairy. It has been outside of his body for so long that it's grown long black hair, and it terrifies her. She is so mortified. She says, "Put it back! Oh my god!" And all of a sudden, there's a change in scene where he takes his wand and he actually splices open his chest in front of her. and puts the heart back into, like, puts it back into the cavity where it hasn't been for so long. Ugh. Oh my God, right?
Like, how desperate and just, yeah, like, grotesque.
So gross.
It's sad and desperate too, though.
Yeah.
No kidding. How so? Like, why would you say it's desperate?
Because she's horrified by it all, and in a desperate attempt to kind of like amend the situation, which is completely unamendable, he slices his own chest open and like roughly sticks it in there. Like, it's just
shoves the hairy heart in there.
It's just so it's tragic.
Oh, it's right? Gross. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's disgusting.
It's gross and tragic.
Yeah.
So yeah, and and so finally he closes it up with magic, and she goes, oh good, now you know what love is, now you can feel what love is really like.
Not quite.
So anyways, back up at the dinner table, we've got all the guests there wondering where these two are.
Meanwhile.
You know. Meanwhile. At the dinner table.
Back on the farm.
Yeah.
Where is the warlock and his fair maiden? So they go around the castle trying to find them, and what they find in the dungeon is a horrific scene. Because the heart has been in his chest for so long, it has grown vicious and perverse, and it has transformed him into essentially a beast. And this is kind of what Dumbledore talks about in his notes. He says that, you know, this heart there's no human qualities left to this heart. It has transformed him into this beast that is going to forcefully take what it wants, right? Basically the scene is she is dead upon the floor and there's blood all over the place, and he wants her heart. So he is actually, her chest is open, and he's holding her beautiful glistening red heart in his hand while he's trying to coax out his hairy heart that he currently has in his body, but his heart is not wanting to budge. And so as a last attempt, he summons a knife. And it says that he hacks out the heart from his chest. And he triumphantly holds the two hearts in his hands with, like, a triumphant expression before he falls dead upon the dead maiden. End of story. End of scene.
That's
so dark.
The worst date in history. It's like...
Like I said, the ultimate, the date from hell.
Yeah, the date from hell. Literally.
It really is.
Yeah.
God, that's so dark for Harry Potter. I think that's the darkest thing we have.
I think it is too.
I think it's easily the darkest thing. But I think there's a lot that speaks to that, in that this whole story is about... there's just so many parallels with the themes of this story to, like, what the themes are in Harry Potter. So really, like, this whole story is about, it revolves around the theme of man versus self, meaning that, you know, this certain character, being the warlock, wants to overcome some kind of battle with him or herself. In this case, the warlock is battling between his selfishness and having to experience true human emotions, which is exactly what Voldemort is battling against, right? Because he's battling between the selfishness of being an all-powerful wizard and giving in to what humans feel, basically. He doesn't want to feel that because he sees that as weakness, right? And the whole theme of the series is love, and I know we've been over this numerous times when we've gone through the series, but I just think that this story is just such a perfect example of why wizards should not meddle in the dark arts. And I love how in Dumbledore's notes it says that, you know, parents wouldn't tell their kids, they wouldn't read their kids these stories right away. They'd wait until they were older to be told these stories.
Yeah, this is like an intermediate level.
Exactly. And this really gets into their head that they don't want to, you know, mess with the dark arts. And I found it so funny that, because there's a little note at the bottom of one of the pages where it says that Beatrix Blossom didn't include this in her Toadstool Tales because
of course
she
didn't.
Was so... So she was so mortified by it that she didn't know how to censor it to make it appropriate for, you know, children. I think that's really interesting.
And another thing, just to go off of that, there's a lot of depth and layers to the story too, in the sense that, like, and with Voldemort and this warlock, ironically, they think, by ripping out their own hearts, by slicing their lives, their souls, and to pieces, that it will strengthen them. But of course, ironically, it weakens them, you know? And I think that when people say, oh, you know, the big theme of the books is love, but it's not enough just to say that. It's about the essential power of love. Without it, you cannot go on.
Well, I think part of that is, yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of it is without love, we are not human. And it just speaks to the true essence of what it means to be human. And essentially, the warlock in this story didn't want to be human, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of a really big... And I find it really interesting because it also says that it really emphasizes that love is a true human thing that only humans can create. And it can only be an authentic human emotion. And it talks about love potions and how even when wizards create love potions or cast spells that are supposed to, you know, facilitate love, it's not true love. It's just infatuation, which just really, that's right. It's lust or it's like extreme attraction or something. Mm-hmm. Right. And that just emphasizes that true love is only something that a human can create or experience or feel.
Or and a living thing, you know, because animals can also love.
Or, yeah, that's right. Or a living thing. That's right. And, I just love the parallels between this story and the series. I just thought it was a really great tale. Mm-hmm. Very graphic, very, lots of pretty gruesome images in my mind, but ultimately, one of my favorite stories because of the themes.
And I think it sticks with you. It's something that
it really does.
And that's the whole point, right? Like that you are kind of floored by it because it's just so, and I think not only because it is so dark and grotesque, that's what really makes it wonderful, but also because it's so sad.
It's tragic. Yeah. It's tragic.
I think part of its power is the image of a heart grown hair because it's like it's the heart, you know, it's supposed to represent like the center of you, like all that is you, your feelings and your emotions,
and here it is pure, innocent part of you,
and here it is outside your body and covered in this like representation of the beast and like the non-humanness,
like an abomination
you. Yeah,
right. And can I just relate this with like what Muggles feel. And I drew a lot of parallels between kind of the moral of this story and also just like human vulnerability and like Muggle vulnerability, I guess. Like lots of people, especially, and I think it might be a cultural thing, but we don't like to feel vulnerable. And when we're in public, many of us don't like to show vulnerability or emotion. And in that sense, we kind of defy ourselves and the way our bodies naturally click, I guess, or naturally tick, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And that's all part of like this, you know, kind of, I know I'm kind of getting a bit philosophical or deep here or whatever, but we do that a lot when we're in public. We're afraid to show emotion.
Yeah.
And we don't want to show that we're weak in a sense of,
survival thing. And I think again,
it's a survival thing. Exactly.
I was listening
to a
podcast recently. I forget which one it was, but it was talking about these psychologists who for years had studied the human emotions and how we resolve our problems and our issues and how we should try to work them out. And I guess the conclusion they came to after years and years of experience and research was that don't focus on the individual, especially like in Western culture. I know I live in a Chinese culture that does not value the individual and the individual's wants and needs and desires in the way that our Western cultures collectively do. And, you know, I think that what the problem with Western culture or cultures that tend to focus more on the individual is that we lose more by focusing just on ourselves. We, you know, when we act stoic in public, in the public arena, what we're just trying to disconnect ourselves to stay strong. But again, that sense of irony that if we were more open and if we were more dependent on each other physically, emotionally, in every way, then we would all gain strength because really we're not individuals. We are all the same.
Yeah.
And they did some like scientific stuff on this and it was, we're physically like part of each other and we can physically almost like, they were talking about ways that we can actually like read each other's thoughts.
Well, it's like Walt Whitman in his Leaves of Grass.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like grass. Grass right. is all like
another classic
together.
Yet
it shares
read.
Roots. I rely on you for this.
I know. I'm feeling quite. I feel a little bit bashful right
but, you
now.
Know, no, it's basically you know Pocahontas, the color of the wind. We are all connected to each other yes. in a circle and a hoop that never ends.
Yes, you had to resort to a Disney reference to get this point across to me. Thank you.
Happens to the best of us.
I appreciate that. Obviously. No, but that's just it. And that is like a recurring theme in literature and like in every single art form, the way how we express ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Ooh, I liked okay. that one, Adam.
Man, we went.
Thank
in.
You. We That's it. I'm finished.
That. Are you?
I'm done.
Okay. Is it my turn? I'm scared. I feel like my
I think
notes
so.
Are weird and a little. Okay.
Just a sec before you start. Yeah. Sarah said that she's 95% done her
okay.
update, and I think I'm just going to invite her to the call just in case she's. Sorry, one sec here.
That took forever. Poor Sarah.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh,
well.
Okay, invite. Okay, so when she finally logs on, it'll call her.
Okay. And okay. if I get...
Continue, Holly.
Okay. I did Babbity Rabbity and Her Cackling Stump, and I love how... I love to enunciate, obviously, because I'm an ESL.
How do you do
teacher.
That? I can't... Stump.
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 You have to, like, pop it. Yeah.
Stump.
Yes.
You pop it.
Oh, I think somebody's in the chat with us
oh,
right now.
Hello.
I'm here.
Hello.
Hey.
You're Holy just cow. In time.
Am I just
you
in
just,
time?
Sarah, yeah, we missed just, you.
We did.
Is everything okay with your computer?
It is now. Oh my gosh, that was the longest update ever.
That was I'm, like, yeah. that was the worst.
I'm so sorry, you guys.
No, no, that's totally fine. We have like three more stories left to go through, so.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll start
totally fine.
Immediately. So I did Babbity Rabbity and Her Cackling Stump.
Okay.
And I love how Rupert Grint says this in the Hollows movie when he's oblivious
Babbity,
to the fact that.
Babbity.
Yeah, and he says stump.
Babbity Rabbity.
Yeah, and it's just his face, like he's kind of goofy and nostalgic and oblivious to the fact that Hermione and Harry don't. Like, didn't grow up with these.
But he's also, like, completely incredulous that
yes.
anyone has ever not heard of Babbity
yeah.
Rabbity and
yes.
Her Cackling
like,
Stump.
Like, that would be him, you know? I just love his character, and I love how Rupert Grint plays him, so. So this
yeah.
tale begins with a foolish king, a greedy charlatan. Charlatan is also one of the best words ever.
Oh, it is.
Definitely is.
It is.
Can you
like,
define
I
it
just...
for the listeners?
Can I define? Okay, it's someone who's like a poser, someone who's pretending to be something they clearly
yeah.
are not.
Oh.
Yeah. So,
a fraud.
A
like
fraud.
A con man.
A con
man. A con
man. Yeah.
That's good.
So, this foolish king, a greedy charlatan, and a kingdom filled with a fearful mix of magical people and muggles. So, the foolish king is really insecure about his mugglehood, and he. Seeks to both obtain exclusive magical power while banishing it across his kingdom. So he reveres magic and he also seeks to banish it, which is the most narcissistic, like, Hitlerish thing ever. So,
yes.
What did this guy's parents do to him to make him this...
Yeah, no kidding, right?
...perverse? So, I was just thinking that we could call the foolish king the Trump of the stump. Or
stump. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I like it.
We have to get a
Love
little
it.
Political here, you know. And we
yeah.
have two,
Trump of the stump.
Two American friends here. We have to honor
yeah.
their presence.
That's not even
Both
getting
of you are,
political.
You're not Republican, right?
Who?
You guys aren't
Heather?
Trump isn't, Trump is isn't even Republican.
No,
yeah,
he's
no,
not.
He's not.
He's just fear-mongering.
He's just corporatin. That's what we'll call
yeah.
him.
He just wants to ban all Muslims from the United States.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Let's not even
insane?
Go there. Seriously.
That would be a whole another podcast, like a whole
that
extra one.
That would be...
Yeah.
We'd
yeah,
have to,
no
like,
kidding.
Open up a whole... Yeah, exactly. So, not only... This... I feel like this is kind of... one of the main, there's a couple of themes in here. So, but the first one is obviously how an example of how damaging it is to rule or lead with fear and greed at the helm of everything you do. Not to get too political again, but it's just, that's a real important lesson for modern society today, yeah, you know, for the collective conscience. Yeah. So the king puts out this notice, like, witches and wizards, you're banned. You know, you're not allowed to be magical. So anything magical that you've been doing, stop. And also,
witches and wizards, Z snap, you're banned.
Yeah, like, end it all right now. Yeah, Z snap. Oh my, like, I've never heard that actually defined verbally. Well, until now.
It's hard to show it over a podcast.
It is so much better, Z snap. I'm going to use that as much as possible today. I'm just going to call people. Anyway, so at the same time, he's like, oh, by the way, if you're a really good wizard, could you, like, come teach me to be a wizard? So he has this army, and he sends out his army, and it's muggles with these vicious hounds, and they go witch hunting, wizard hunting. So this greedy charlatan learns about the foolish king's reign of terror that's going on, his campaign of terror, like J.K. Rowling says, and right, he's like, oh, this is my chance to go fool this guy, this stupid idiot, into thinking that I'm a great sorcerer, and I'm going to take advantage of him and all of his riches. So he does. He approaches the king, and he says, you know, if you give me all this gold and all these treasures, I'll teach you how to be a wizard. And of course, the king is so ignorant and desperate that he agrees to it. And so begins this whole Jafar and the Sultan story, you know?
No kidding.
It's very much in line with that.
Yes. So
one day, while Jafar, the charlatan, goes out and, like, literally snaps a twig off a tree to use as a wand, which I find is hilarious.
That's funny.
That's how I got my wand when I was, like, 12.
Right? Like, or your that's collection awesome. Of different wands. I think it's just JK's way of highlighting the ridiculous in this story. So, while he's snapping the twig off the tree, Babbity Rabbity, old Babbity, who's watching at the edge of the wood, you know, she's that woman, she's that banished old woman, living at the edge of the palace grounds.
That's that witch that you're warned never to go meet.
That's right. So she also happens to be the laundry lady.
she's busy.
She's, you know, she's a jack of all. So she, there's a bit of a forerunner to explain her skill that she has. It says, it talks about how the linens are, like, fragrant, white, and really clean. So I guess that's kind of a hint as to she might have some hidden skill or talent. And I think anyone who has read the books might catch on to that, you know? Anyway, quite subtle. So Babbity sees this charlatan for what he really is, and one day when him and the king are out practicing their silly little wand tricks, Babbity can't help herself, and she is, like, howling with laughter at them. And so the king's like, oh my god, this old woman's laughing at me, I'm an idiot, this is so embarrassing.
Yes.
Z-snap. Yeah, and I quit, and you better have this sorted, organize something that makes me look good, and if you fail me, I'm going to chop your head off. So the charlatan was obviously afraid and super angry, so to perpetuate that fear and anger, the chain of fear and anger, he approaches Babbity, and he's like, listen, old lady, I see you, I know what you are, you're either going to help us, pretend that we're magical, or I'm going to kill you. So Babbity was like, yeah, fine. That's totally cool. And she said, oh, by the way, I have a question. What if, good sir, you ask me to do something, a trick or a spell that I can't perform? What then? And he's like, what could you not do? I mean, anything that the king is going to attempt, you'll be able to pull off. So I guess I'm confusing things a little bit. I should say exactly what he asked her to do. So he said, tomorrow we're putting on this performance for the lords and the ladies. And what I want you to do is when the king is pretending to perform a trick, you actually perform that trick to make it look like he's doing it. So you make him look magical by actually hiding in a bush performing magic. And she says, yeah, sure, no problem. But, you know, what if there's something that's requested and I just can't do that? And so the charlatan, in his own ignorance, says, what are you not going to be able to do? Like, come on. So right now we should be thinking like, uh-huh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day comes and several silly tricks are performed. And then someone, a soldier, comes up on the stage and he says, look, during the witch hunt yesterday, one of my dogs died, was poisoned by something. Could you bring him back to life? And of course, the charlatan, who has no idea about anything because he's a muggle, says, yeah, sure, the king can do that. And the king says, yes, of course, you know. And Babidi knows whether she predicted this or whether she, I don't know how she knew this was going to happen. We'll just blame it on her wisdom. Sure. Of course she can't perform this because this is the golden rule in magic. Mm-hmm. You cannot.
I was just going to say.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like that's the one thing that's, like, always discussed over and over again as an example of how magic does have its end and it cannot achieve everything, because it's talked about in, like, the Resurrection Stone and, like, after, I think either Cedric or Sirius died, they, like, repeated over and over again that there's no magic yet known to man that can bring back the dead.
None at all, and it's just something that wizards continue to grapple with more than muggles, because there's so many things that they can do that would be seemingly defeating the impossible, but this is just the one thing that they can't undo. And of course, this is the central theme, among other things, you know, among other, like, moral aspects. This is just the one thing. It's kind of like just giving you the gritty truth in a fairy tale, like teaching children, guess what? People die, and that's a reality of life, and you're going to have to process that and work through it. So, what happens is, the climax is, of course, Babidi cannot perform this trick. The king and the charlatan are soon revealed. They're very quickly revealed. And the people turn on him, and, of course, they reveal, in an act of desperation, they reveal Babidi. And then the people turn on her, and they want to kill her, and she's running away from them, and she hides in a tree, in a big tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people, the muggles, in their ignorance, think that she turned herself into a tree somehow. But she's talking to them, you know, and they say, just slice the tree in half, cut down the tree. So they do, and they think they've defeated her. And she says, you idiots, do you think you can actually slice a wizard in half and kill them? Which we all know, yes, you can.
Yes.
And obviously we realize that she wasn't the tree, that she's just hiding in the tree. So, you know, but the muggles don't know this. So she says, look, you didn't kill me, but you've cursed your kingdom by doing all of these wicked things. So now you're going to pay. And you can't kill a wizard by slicing them. Try the grand sorcerer, aka the charlatan. So in an act of desperation, the charlatan's like, no, I'm a fraud. Don't kill me, you know?
It was all fake.
It was all fake. And long story short, she says, look, people, learn your lesson. I'm out of here. Just do good from now on. Confess your sins. Move on peacefully. Don't do any harm to any witch or wizard ever again, and you'll be fine. The king says, yes, of course, you know. And then she leaves. She, like, she's like, you know, I quit this bitch. So she leaves.
Yes!
Yay, men.
And
at the very end, we realize that she has turned herself in to a little white rabbit. So, there's two things here. I'm wondering if it's the, you know, when you find a rabbit in a hat. Like, are these the origins of a rabbit?
I hadn't even thought. I thought of a lot of things, but that was not one of them.
Wow. Right. Well, the first time I read the story, that's what I thought. I was like, oh, she's making that connection. Whether it's in actual folklore or not, I'm not sure. But she's trying to make a connection to one of those cliches. Kind of like...
I love that.
The Killing Curse. Yeah. Like, it's, yes. The Killing Curse sounds like... Abracadabra.
It's true.
Right.
So, and, yeah.
Considering the way that she, I don't know if you guys have talked about this or not, but considering the way that she came up with this title, it could have been that she was trying to make the story fit the title, and that was something that she thought of, making that connection. You know what I mean?
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Like, this really amusing and thoughtful, something thoughtful to me. So, the interesting part of this story is we know that in Dumbledore's notes, I'm running out of time, so I'll just focus on one aspect of his notes. He talks about this is the first time that, Animagus?
Yep.
So we'd say Animagi. Yep. This is the first time that Animagi are ever mentioned in wizard folklore.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah. Wow. So it would be 15th century, 1400s.
Right.
And
yes.
He says, you know, obviously Muggles are completely ignorant to the physics of magic, because if you transfigure yourself into a tree, you'd be inanimate. You wouldn't be able to speak. You'd be a tree.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You transfigured yourself into a rabbit, you couldn't speak human language. You're a rabbit, you know, and because Muggles are so ignorant, they just would swallow anything. You know, they wouldn't know. Their common sense is out the window because they're completely oblivious to anything to do with magic. And another thing is, he's like, you know, we have to understand that if you transfigured it, Babbity Rabbity was an animagus, because if she transfigured herself, she wouldn't be able to untransfigure herself.
Yeah.
Really, she'd just be turning herself into a rabbit. Mm-hmm. And then she would immediately forget that she was a rabbit. And so he talks about, like, animagus status and how and why people had to register, and he just talks about, he relates that to the ignorance of Muggles, and I think
is really cool.
Yeah. And
now, if I recall correctly, I think that there are a lot of stories about whatever happened to Merlin, and I think that one of them ends with him turning himself into an oak tree. You guys heard of that before? Yeah. So I guess there's I guess she's like playing in with the long history of English wizards becoming trees.
Right, and you could even, that's a really good, I'm sure it's very closely related. It's probably based on that. I mean, if you asked her, if you did some research. And another thing, you can even connect it to the wider world, like The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, where trees are a symbol of wisdom. The Ents,
yes.
They're a symbol of wisdom and authority and longevity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in this story, she, I think in the theme of ingenuity and common sense being valuable, it's kind of saying, like, you can't turn into a tree and still be a smart human. You're just a tree. So use your common sense and discretion when you're practicing magic. And I guess the biggest theme is you just can't bring people back from the dead. And this is a hard truth that you have to realize from a young age. Otherwise, you're going to make a lot of mistakes along the way. And Dumbledore does say that this is this fairy tale where children did find out that you can't bring people back to life.
I find that really interesting, because the theme of death just sort of emanates from all of these stories in some way.
Mm-hmm. Always, like, always.
Yes. There's some sort of, like, immortality theme that's, you know, it's not just from one story. Like, she really, J.K. Rowling really likes the whole immortality, you know, vulnerability theme.
Well, it all goes back to
everyone. Integrates does.
It. Yes. I mean,
everybody does, yeah.
The big, quintessentially, you know, to be human question. And
exactly.
I think, too, she admits in a lot of her interviews that she does, a lot of her, you know, comments that she makes. It all goes back to her mom's untimely death and her mom's illness and just her grappling with that and coming to terms with it.
Right. And, like, I guess you could tie that in with, like, you know, the purpose of Dementors and how they make you feel when they're around you. And
I totally... That was really disorganized.
Totally not.
I thought it was great.
I thought it was good, too.
Thanks, guys. But, thanks, guys. But, I don't know. This isn't my favorite story, but I...
No, Adam and I got the best ones.
You really did.
Yeah. And I just randomly selected them. I did.
Right.
I swear to God.
Okay,
I randomly selected them.
That was random.
Oh God, it's a mutiny.
Sarah and I really got the great end of that random stick.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel bad now.
I'm kidding. No, I like I do like the story, and I think the commentary is just interesting. But it's not my favorite.
Yeah, but it's still a good story. I like all of the stories.
And it's a good
I just really love this book in general because it's just so full of themes and morals, and I love that Dumbledore, who is like one of my favorite characters because of his wisdom and all of his quotes, and like I've kind of you know I've really taken to heart some of the things that I've read that Dumbledore has said in the books, and I just love that she's integrated that with this book, and it's just good. I love this book. It's really,
and it's fun.
It's fun. It's a good book of fairy tales.
It really is.
Anyways.
That's
Sarah,
all.
I'm happy you've joined us again.
Mm-hmm. Finally.
Finally.
Are you ready to analyze?
I'm ready to analyze
It's Ralph Fiennes' birthday.
Oh,
it's just the fun little
happy
fact
birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. All right, take her away, Sarah.
Okay, I'm going to kind of get through the plot of this story because I think there's some more interesting things happening afterwards. So,
okay.
Basically, the story is about an old man, and he was a wizard, and so he used his...
Sorry, which one is yours again?
Oh, I'm sorry. I am the Wizard and the Hopping Pot.
Okay.
the first one.
Yeah, the first one. We're going backwards.
Right.
He was an old man, and he used his hopping pot, or his cauldron, actually, as like a do-good for the muggles in his village. You know, if they had ailments or whatever, he would do something to fix it, and he would pretend that it came from his cooking pot, is what he called it. So he passes away, and he leaves everything to his son, who obviously is also a wizard, but is not a pro-muggle wizard, is in fact very, against muggles. Okay, so...
A purist.
Yeah, he's anti-muggle. A purist, thank you. Anti-muggle, that's better. So now he finds the pot, and was there a package with it? Yes, hidden inside the cooking pot.
I'm following you, literally.
I know, that's what I was doing. Hidden inside the pot was a little, it was a little package bearing his name, and when he opened it, it was a little slipper. Just one, not another one, just one. He had no clue what to do with it, so he threw it in the cauldron and decided he was going to use that as a garbage can, because that's all it was good for. So that very night, a woman comes and knocks on the door, and she's upset because her granddaughter is afflicted with warts. And he gets upset, basically, and says, you know, be gone or whatever, and closes the door in her face. And all of a sudden, he hears this weird, like, clinging noise. And he goes to see what it is, and it is the hopping pot, which has now grown a foot and some warts.
So creepy.
I know, it kind
and
of is,
disgusting.
Isn't it?
And gross.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Like, the worst of it.
No, it's like, it's so, like, fun. It's because it's like,
no, she wasn't like that at all. That's actually just
I
did.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
because it's like this useful, like everyday household object becoming animated, and it's sort of reminds me of Beauty and the Beast with
Chip.
In one of the versions of Beauty and the Beast I read, they actually like set about like making macaroni and cheese in one of the the pots, and then, like, they all eat, all the furniture eats it. So, anyway, that's just what I'm thinking of. It's weird.
Although it's an interesting, again, it's an interesting comparison to, you know.
Yeah.
The weirdest part is, though, the pot follows him around all night and keeps him up all night. It won't let him sleep. It keeps hopping around with its
like
words.
His
I know, right?
Yeah.
So the next morning comes, and now a man comes to the door, and he's lost his donkey, and he's asking for help. Because he, now, without his donkey, he can't go to the market to get food, and he's hungry. Again, right. The wizard slams the door. So now the hopping pot is braying like a donkey, and it's making, like, human hunger sounds.
Yeah, that's right. It's groaning.
On top of its warts, and the fact that it's hopping around. And so then that evening, a sobbing woman comes to the door saying that her baby is ill and she needs help. And again, the wizard slams the door in her face. He's got enough issues with this pot. And now this hopping pot that's braying like a donkey and is hungry and has warts is now filled over with this woman's tears.
Oh my goodness.
So no.
Besieged by problems. At problem upon problem.
So no more villagers come, but still, like, these different ailments keep coming to this pot. You know, it keeps, like, it's, to quote it, it's choking, it's retching, it's crying, it's whining like a dog. It's, this is the gross. It's spewing bad cheese and sour milk.
Oh, no.
It's so gross. Oh, my God.
And
that
hungry
is just a whole other level of disgusting.
Like, it is.
I feel like I've maybe never given this story, like, enough credit.
I know.
And just enjoying this so much, like your retelling of it.
Yeah. Like, her paraphrasing.
I have to tell you, it was quite funny rereading it.
Yeah, it's in line with Ron puking up slugs. Like, it's that same kind of humor.
That is what I thought of too when I read that part.
Juvenile humor that we can all snicker at.
Which, of course, is what I love the most because it's me, and so, you know. Okay, so the wizard cannot stand it anymore. This hopping pot is driving him nuts, and he runs outside, and he basically starts, like, correcting everything. He starts throwing his wand around, and the donkey is found in a briar patch and comes home, and then the warts are gone from the granddaughter, and the baby is better, and everything is well. Mm-hmm. And then the pot burps out the slipper. That he had thrown into it so that he can put it on his little foot.
What?
Oh, Gucci, 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 Gucci.
Oh, weird.
It's a booty. It's a little booty for your pot.
And so they hop back to the house, and it's happily ever after. Okay, so...
I love that story.
I know that was really quick, but okay, so it took until the end of this story, though, to think, oh, why didn't I ever think about the slipper on the foot when the foot first came out?
Right.
Okay, and then my other question is, now that the foot's out, but yet the wizard is doing all of this, like, he's fixed everything, why is there still a foot? Why is there still a need for
there.
A slipper?
Yeah, that's right. Why doesn't the foot just disappear now that he's fixed everyone's ailments? Yeah.
Maybe it only disappears when it's not in action. Like, it wasn't in action.
Right.
The pot, the cauldron, when it was being transported between, like, the dead father and the son, and now... Maybe. That's just my interpretation of it, because I really want, like, the wizard to still have his little cauldron friend with him.
I do like the fact that it hops around.
Yeah. And I don't like the fact that it follows him all over the place, though.
No, not when it's, like, full of warts and tears.
I feel like...
If it wasn't, I would still get pretty frustrated having a pot following him.
Yeah, I feel like...
It'd be so convenient, though.
Well,
to carry your stuff, or like
if it wasn't so annoying, it reminds me of Alice in Wonderland. Like, I feel like she was stoned when she wrote this.
Yeah,
it is about pot.
Yeah, it is about a pot. Or
it is
about
pot.
And it's like it's supposed to be a helper, right? And it's like what you're saying, Heather. It's like dormant when it's not in use. It kind of reminds me of Baymax. Did you guys see Big Hero 6?
I love that movie.
I love that movie so much, too.
Sorry, what is that movie?
It's just like Baymax is a robot who helps people, and when he's not being used, he just kind of like shuts himself off, kind of like you know, the robot in Star Wars?
C4XO, right?
Right, no. Hey, was that a trick answer?
See, that a trick answer?
Are you messing with me, Heather?
Yeah, yeah.
Again. Again.
No.
Yeah, never, right? Anyway, continue.
Okay, so there's actually like there's a couple things about this. First, in Dumbledore's notes, I love this. I'm just going to quote this one little part that's funny. It says, "A simple and heartwarming fable, one might think, in which case one would reveal oneself to be an innocent nincompoop."
Yeah, right.
Strong language from Dumbledore.
Right. Potty mouth. What are they offended?
This also, this story, I don't think that it has the most translations, but it has two kind of prominent translations that throughout the years, things have changed. So, like, one thing that we learn here is that, or what we think is that, Beedle was from the time, the era where it was the persecution of witches and wizards, where all the Muggles were after them and didn't want them around. So one of the stories that comes up through all of this, because, you know, obviously if all the Muggles are hunting the witches and wizards, they need to go into hiding. And so as they're going into hiding, they become more anti-Muggle because the right. Muggles are making them hide. And so the story then became more anti-Muggle. And basically the biggest thing that changed was that the Hopping Pot stayed wardy, and I think still had the foot. But as the Muggles were coming to the door for help, the Hopping Pot would eat the Muggles.
Ooh, that's dark.
And then so it would eat the Muggles. And then so finally, when
that
it was...
That escalated quickly.
I know it did. And so finally, when there's only a few villagers left, they come to the wizard and they're like, hey, you know, we'll leave you alone and you can practice your magic as long as you don't hurt us. But can you let our Muggles go? And so the Hopping Pot spits out all the Muggles. It says that they're perfectly fine, but slightly mangled.
Oh. That's not perfectly fine.
Yeah, that's not fine at all.
I'm not sure what slightly mangled means, but...
I'd say a little bit chewed up and, like...
Yeah, know, like twisted a little.
Maybe brain dead?
It's
contorted a little bit.
Contorted, yeah.
I'm thinking like a really bad splinching or something has happened.
Ooh, right.
Yeah.
And then you know what? Before I go on to the other translation, one of the other questions that I had, I guess this is kind of going back to the original story, is what do you guys think about the wizard as far as the Hopping Pot, quote-unquote, driving him to the point of where he needed to help everybody? Do you think that he sacrificed his free will and helped everybody, or do you think he learned a lesson from the story?
I think it's like what... I said before, it's his conscience that the Hopping Pot represents, and he knew that he should have been helping these wizards, not only because it was the right thing to do, but it was because what his father would have wanted him to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually that caught up with him, and he began to do that work himself.
I think that's perfectly said. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's just a metaphorical conscience.
So you guys don't think in any way, shape, or form that he sacrificed his own free will, that he didn't want to do that?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think that's part of sometimes doing the right thing.
Yeah, and it's not like he got rid of all of his free will. Mm-hmm. He could have still done other things with his time. He's not, like, constantly 24/7 healing, like, Muggle children with warts.
That's true, because there was only one lady on the first day, and then I think two on the second. So it's not like you're spending your entire life.
Not a big chunk of time.
And another part of it is, in order to truly set himself free and get some reprieve, he did the right thing. So also sending the message like he was driven to do the right thing because he wanted some reprieve from being burdened by all of this chaos that was going on. And it's just representative of the chaos that would be in all the noise and all the chaos in your mind when something is plaguing you.
Mm-hmm. And therefore he actually freed himself a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I like that.
I like that too.
Cool.
Okay, so the last, real quick, the last translation of the book that I found kind of funny is apparently there was a lady by the name of Beatrix Bloxham.
Oh, oh yes.
We discussed her earlier.
Yeah, oh, did you guys talk about her. It? Okay. So this story, she totally like wimped it out. It went hoppity hoppity hop, and she called the wizard Wee Willikins, which I thought was kind of funny.
Oh, man. Wow.
She totally wimped that one out.
Yeah, like she, I don't know. I don't like this Beatrix girl.
I don't like her either.
No. She kind of reminds me of Umbridge. But, like, yeah. An Umbridge who's really involved with PTA meetings, like, overly involved.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I agree with that.
She kind
totally
of reminds me of Rita Skeeter, but, like, you know, in a way that instead of blowing things up, she's trying to, like, keep things, trying to make things bland.
Either way, she distorts things.
I was just going to say that. Did you say contorts?
Distort.
Oh, I was going to say she contorts the story to a way. But, yeah, same, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that is the Wizard in the Hopping Pot.
Awesome. That was great, Sarah.
Thanks.
I like how Dumbledore's commentary enriches the story. Without it, I think the story would just be kind of more towards what Beatrix would want, you know, but with Dumbledore giving some insight, it's with a lot of fairy tales in the Muggle world, you know, until you study them, in university or
as I've done,
what? As you've done, as I have done as well. I think that you gain insight later when you're an adult or when you're old enough to understand what they really mean. And Dumbledore really,
and when you have to translate them to your own children.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So
right.
I think the commentary really stands out more than the story itself because it just represents how important fairy tales are if we're able to take a closer look.
I think this is definitely a story for younger audiences as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think so too. I think all of the stories are kind of like on an age spectrum scale kind of thing.
And yes, that because they're definitely
probably
not
for the youngest audience, whereas maybe the Warlocks Harry Hart is probably for the oldest.
Yes, yeah. I totally agree there because I was thinking that one definitely was not a children's story.
Right. No.
And it's the first story, so I think we're definitely on point when it comes, you know, here's a simple start, you know, and then as we go deeper, it gets darker and more
grotesque.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
More deep, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So, cool.
Well done,
awesome.
Folks.
Well done. Nice. So do we want to, I was thinking, like, we do have one more story left, mm-hmm. but we did go through that. Like, we've gone through the tale of the three brothers, but I was thinking maybe if we read through the notes at all, we could just maybe talk about some of the notes.
I do have something to say. It's a very possibly controversial theory.
Okay.
That I've stumbled across in my time on the internet about the tale of three brothers. Okay, and also it'll kind of like be a nice little recap as well for what the story is. Mm-hmm. And the theory is that Dumbledore is death. And basically, basically, the story goes that, like, the first brother, who's combative, and, like, he brags about his power, and he's very violent, he's supposed to represent Voldemort, and that his ultimate downfall is, like, his thirst for power.
Right? I've heard this story before.
Yeah. And then the second brother, who's arrogant and wants to humiliate death, he is supposed to represent Snape. Mm-hmm. And his deepest desire is to be with a woman that he can't have.
Mm.
And that eventually leads to his death. And what I think is super interesting about that is that in the tale of the three brothers, the woman, they never actually mention if she wanted to be with him or not. It's not established that they were, like, married or fiancé or, like, it just says that she's dead. And that's why
she's cloaked couldn't be with him. In, like, this elusive veil of death.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and it's like, maybe not.
Like,
she gets no say in whether or not she wants to be brought back
to
be with the second brother, which reminded me a lot of how Snape viewed Lily.
Yeah. Unfinished business and unrequited love.
Absolutely. Yeah, and also, like, not even, like, she wanting to be involved in that love.
Right.
Right.
Which
So, who's the third brother, then?
The third brother is Harry, because he just wants to be left alone by death. And in his life, and Harry stays under the invisibility cloak until he decides that he's ready to die and takes off the cloak and walks into the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And then he greets death as an old friend, and the friend that he meets there at King's Cross is Dumbledore. Like, right. His old friend Dumbledore is yes. there.
Right.
And, like, he... Then he's given the choice to go on with him.
I love that.
Back.
I love that.
I loved,
love,
like,
it. A third brother. Yes.
I love that this theory, too.
Yeah.
And I can't believe it took us as a fandom so long to come up with it. I only heard
to
it,
figure it
just
out.
A couple years ago, and it's...
Yeah.
It's perfect, I think.
I think it's a definite parallel that...
Yes.
Joe Rowling was cognizant of as she was writing. Mm-hmm. I think that she purposefully yeah. created that, and she mm-hmm, purposely drew that parallel. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty amazing if there was, you know, she created both stories and they just happened to be perfectly parallel. Yeah. Like
right.
That. Like,
I mean,
that
it
obviously
is,
had
it
some
is
thought
beautiful
put
writing
it.
There. Just so, like, artfully designed.
It
right.
Exactly. I think, I don't, I think it's not, I don't think it's a theory. I think it's just the truth, you know? It's, mm-hmm. it's, and I think maybe... Because Harry's life was predicted, you know, because there was an, what's it called? There was a prophecy.
Yeah, like, you know? Death did lay out his life for him.
Right, like, that story is part of that prophecy, couldn't it be?
Mm-hmm. I can believe it, for sure.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, or am
it,
I...
It yeah. No, yeah. I think it makes complete yeah. sense, Holly, actually.
Yeah. I just cool. want to choose to believe that... That's sort of as connected as you know. It just fits together perfectly.
I think so too, yeah. And I can see how. Yeah, you want them to be that interconnected, like you were saying. Yep.
Yeah.
So, can we just? Sorry, I'm gonna like change the topic here on you guys. I just wanted to talk really quickly before we wrap things up about just some mm-hmm. things in Albus Dumbledore's notes.
Definitely.
First of all, I love how Dumbledore kind of gives an overview of, and I'm just going to briefly mention this, but I love how he gives an overview of the Elder Wand's history and mm-hmm. how, and you know, like he's kind of looked through periods of time and he gives us glimpses or snapshots of periods in time where certain, you know, antagonistic wizards have, you know, claimed this wand or have, you know, died or disappeared mysteriously or something like that. But I find
kind of
it
like
really
the Holy Grail or any like piece of
yeah.
like, physical folklore that like it comes and goes throughout history and like there you see it, there you don't.
Yeah, exactly. And I find it really interesting though, because okay, at the beginning of the book it says that Albus wrote the notes for this book about 18 months before the events of his death.
Right, yeah.
Before the events of the tower.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking, and, like, summer so yeah, after the fourth book.
Summer after the fourth book, I guess, hey? Was
yes.
that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, Voldemort's just come back. And...
Right.
Would
okay,
that be
so
after
Voldemort's
he
just come
destroyed
back.
The ring and destroyed his hand?
That's right, though. That's what I'm trying to piece together.
No,
is
that'd
what?
Be before.
Before?
Because he did that... Because he destroyed the ring in his hand.
In the beginning of
the
sixth
book.
Yeah, okay. So no, this would have been before that.
Yeah.
So he has not found the stone yet, and he owns the Elder Wand, and I'm pretty sure he knows yeah. that that's the Elder Wand.
Oh, yeah.
He also knows that he's given away the Cloak of Invisibility.
Yes.
Harry has the Cloak of Invisibility.
Mm-hmm. So he knows those
but I
two
find
things.
I find it really funny, or really interesting, that he's, you know, written in his notes here that, and quote, "Nobody has ever claimed to have found Death's Cloak," which I guess is true, because...
Yeah.
While he knows that Harry has it, like, nobody's really...
Nobody
I mean,
claimed
the Potter's
it.
Never claimed that's what it was.
Exactly.
Yeah, nobody's claimed it, even though he knows. The stone has never been found either, even though I'm pretty sure he knows where it is.
He has it. He has
it. I don't think
stone.
He has it at that point.
Not when he's writing
oh,
this, I don't
oh,
think.
Oh,
not
oh,
when
oh,
he's writing this one.
Okay.
And then the wand, many claim... Oh, yeah, he talks about how many claim their wand is made of Elder and blah, 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 but he also says that... Oh, maybe... Wait a second. Maybe I'm just messing up here. I think it says in the notes here that nobody's claimed to have the wand as well.
He got it from Grindelwald, though.
Well, people have claimed to have it, but...
People have claimed to have it, but he doesn't...
Proven.
He doesn't explicitly say that he doesn't have it. So I yeah. find this really funny, because he's sort of brushing off, you know... He knows exactly where these things are, but he's sort of brushing off the idea, right? He's kind
yeah.
of like
well, I think
avoiding
he's certainly not going to put it in writing where, like, he left all of this
absolutely.
In his will to Hogwarts. He's certainly not going to put it in writing just in case maybe Harry's mission, or maybe he didn't know the mission that was coming or whatever, but what if that didn't come to fruition? Then he's not going
right.
to just, hey, by the way, the other one's in my grave with me.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I sort of had a parallel idea to that, because I think in the introduction it talks about how, like, of course, oh, Dumbledore didn't mention everything he knew in it. But then in his notes on the Tale of Three Brothers, he says that believing in the Hollows is a desperate hope. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like the idea that Dumbledore actually believes that it is a desperate hope to believe in the Hollows, because
I agree.
It's sort of like this is like the last ditch effort that he can come up with to like save the wizarding world.
Right.
And it's like the only thing he can think of, and it's like, I don't know, I think it's just like, not that I necessarily think that's actually what happened, I just think it kind of adds some drama to the story, and
and
that's why Dumbledore couldn't ever actually like leave proper instructions for Harry, because he's like, it was just like on a wing and a prayer kind of thing.
And that's an answer to the age-old fandom question, why didn't he reveal more? Because he wasn't 100% sure. He was working really hard in his office.
And, like, right up to the minute,
figuring it out, right up to the minute. You know, and, like, when you think back in the books, when it's like, oh, when we look in the Marauder's Map, there's Dumbledore pacing his office. Like, he's working things out all the time.
Like, he does that a lot.
Yeah.
He does that a lot.
And, like, he's another thing, too... Even though I think even if he wrote that when he knew the Hollows existed, remember what he says about the truth. The truth is a dangerous thing, and it should be treated with caution. He's not just going to say, just because they might exist, it doesn't mean everyone or anyone should know about it, because it's dangerous.
Right.
So
right.
maybe that's, I mean, he was a big fan of concealment, because he just really wanted to gingerly handle the terrible truths of that world, of their world.
Yeah. And I think in the end, it paid off. His concealment paid off in the end.
It did.
Oh, absolutely.
It did.
Yeah.
But he took, like Heather was saying, what is it? Like, it's a desperate hope?
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Grasping at straws, kind of like, well, this is the last thing I can think of. This is all we've got, so we have to go with it.
Right. So I think that definitely requires a hella secrecy. Like, you know, you can't just say, like, here's what I'm attempting to do, like, the impossible, basically. Watch me, watch me at it, you know.
No, I like that, Heather. No. I like that, you know, like you're saying, the desperate attempt. I like that analysis.
I also just wanted to mention that I find it interesting the time period at which Albus Dumbledore is writing these notes. So, as we just kind of, like, figured out, it's the summer after Voldemort has returned. And so I feel like this is when all of the sort of Deathly Hallows things or ideas or feelings or whatever would sort of reignite inside Dumbledore, in a sense, because evil has now returned. Yes. He knows that Harry's life is in danger. He knows, like, what both of them have to do, right? Neither one can live while the other survives. And he's starting... I just think it makes perfect sense to kind of place this Beetle the Bard, these Beetle the Bard notes within that time period, if that makes any sense. Like,
no, I agree. You know,
like,
now
it's starting,
like,
to come up again, kind of thing.
Full force.
It's
ahead.
Not like he would. It's not like he would have any time to write treatises on fairy tales unless they had something like definite to do.
To do,
with,
yeah.
The grand mission against Voldemort. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And there was just one more thing. Does anybody else have anything they want to bring up before I just close off here?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, my last point was, I just wanted to read the very last paragraph of this book, because I think it's a beautiful paragraph, and it just finishes the book so nicely. It's in Dumbledore's notes, and he says, "But which of us would have shown the wisdom of the third brother if offered the pick of death's gifts? Wizards and muggles alike are imbued with the lust for power. How many would resist the wand of destiny? Which human being, having lost someone they loved, could withstand the temptation of the resurrection stone? Even I, Albus Dumbledore, would find it easiest to refuse the invisibility cloak, which only goes to show that, clever as I am, I remain just as big a fool as anyone else." Aww. Oh!
Such a humble
love
man.
Love it!
Yeah.
Absolutely love it.
Yes.
And just, that speaks to, and I just love how that itself ties in with what we were talking about, this reoccurring theme of immortality and vulnerability.
And how you have to accept death.
And you have to accept death, and it all applies to Dumbledore as well, and how he tried to, you know, evade death with his obsession.
But then he freely goes to it. Like,
and he freely goes to it in the end.
But
that's
the real... But who we should really focus on here is the answer to the question is Harry.
Harry would.
Harry did.
Well...
Harry did, yeah.
Yes,
and he says that he would want the Resurrection Stone, though, in, like, the middle of Deathly Hallows when they first find out about it.
But what does he do at the end? He throws it in the woods.
Eventually he does leave it behind.
He drops it. He gets rid of it.
The only one of the Hallows that he keeps is the Invisibility Cloak, and then he passes that down to his sons.
Yes, because that is the family heirloom. And, like, it is kind of the, I don't want to call it the weakest link, but it's the most benign. It's the most benevolent.
Well,
it's not the most dramatic.
I think it's the most noble link.
I agree.
So
it can be used most humbly and like
practical. I think it's
pragmatic. I mean, if you're a thief, of course it's going to help you. But if you're just trying to evade evil and darkness and or filch or then it's good too. But I think I love that question. But which of us would have shown the wisdom of the third brother? It's just so, it's Harry, and that's like, oh, he did, you know, and it's like before he died, Dumbledore's asking this question, and as fans, when we read that, it should be like, really sentimental. We should be like, Harry did, you know?
Sobbing all over the place.
But we should also be thinking about ourselves and, like, thinking that, like,
assessing.
We should try and strive to be the third brother.
Should we?
And pick that option.
Yes. Yeah, but if we fail along the way, it's all right. You know, Dumbledore's like, I'm a fool, you're a fool. It's okay, but try your best.
Learn from it.
That's right.
And again, that's what this whole book is about, right? You learn from it.
That's what fairy tales are about.
That's right.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. I love this book. This was great, you guys.
It was great.
It really was fantastic.
Guys, you know what just hit me recently?
What's that?
This is sort of like dramatically changing the subject matter.
That we're old. Guys.
But, well, yeah.
That
I was
hits
gonna
me
say,
every day, like, but anyway.
Yeah, like my birthday is on January 7th, so it's coming up.
Yeah.
But I'm going to be 23 years old.
Oh my God.
And that was... Yeah, well, first of all, I'm going to be 23, which I feel like old now.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Especially since, like, Heather and I were, like, 15 and 16 when we first met each other and started up the podcast.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
God, I'm 33, by the way.
We met when we were 15
and
16.
Oh, I don't even want to hear it, Holly.
We started the podcast when we were 16.
Yeah. See, Holly, I remember meeting you when you were just married and you were 28 years old.
Yes, I was. You remember? Yeah. That's so sweet. I remember.
And the thing
I'll
is,
never forget the first time I met you and Heather. I'll never forget the first time I listened to you guys, and I just fell in love with you. I know I told you the story a million times, but I was like, they're so smart and they're cute and they're funny, and I like was talking back to you like I did with Pottercast, but I started like binge listening to you guys because it was all canon, and I was like, yes, like finally someone
is
just doing all
canon. We were
canon.
Pretty cute and funny.
You were.
Cute little cuties.
You guys were awesome.
But also, I remember when I was 17, and that's when I first met Chio.
Oh my God!
Right, and that's like one of my first true like male, you know, Harry Potter friends.
Really?
Well, that was when you first met Theo, because remember we didn't
know. Theo, that's right.
Oh, you called him Theo. Did he write a fan letter to you guys?
He wrote in a couple times, and
he was
I
in
found out,
the My Leaky group.
Yes, and then I found out that he was a grad. Well, him and I would like, it was kind of like a Heather and I similar situation where we'd send big long emails to each other. So Chio and I would send big long emails and we'd talk about like Harry Potter stuff. And then I found out that Chio was a graphic designer and he agreed to redesign the website. And then after that, I kind of coaxed him into being a podcast host.
Right.
And I just remember like, When I met Chio, I was 16, just turned 17, and Chio was 23. And now I'm 23, and Chio is like, 28 or, 4, 5, 6, 7, 28, turning 29 or something.
Oh, he's 29,
like.
Yeah, I knew he wasn't. Yeah, he's a bit younger than us.
Oh.
Yeah. Sarah, are you the same age as me?
Oh, no.
You're older.
I was like 33 when I started podcasting with you guys.
So that was 3 years ago?
I'm 37.
You're like, why are you focusing
on
that?
You're 37.
I'm 37. I just turned 37, yeah.
You seem so much younger.
I know,
than
you
ever,
really
ever
do. But here's the thing, really, Heather. Do. Like, honestly, I used to think 10 years ago I would have said something. Like, I would have been like, oh, you seem so much. But we don't realize that we're getting you know, right, Sarah? Like, you don't
feel... It's true. I still feel like 37? I'm, like, in my 20s.
Yeah.
But you're fun.
Right. I know. You are fun.
Oh,
yeah. You've alienated all of the listeners.
You're young,
over
too.
37.
No, but sometimes when people get older, they do start to change, you know, especially sometimes maybe when people have different certain responsibilities or a certain job or have kids or whatever.
Right.
Go through some grief or something that does age them. But I feel like some people are just kind of forever young, and I feel like Sarah, you're definitely one of those people in a good way.
I strive to be that way.
In a good way.
I will always be that way.
I like it. Can I just quickly throw out, we're talking about Harry Potter friends. My friend Natalia, who I WhatsApp with, who's like actually my friend, I met her on My Leaky almost 10 years ago, and we're actual friends, and we chat on Facebook, and we WhatsApp each other, and we still talk, and we Skype sometimes, and we don't talk about Harry Potter really anymore. Yeah. We just talk about life, and I met her on My Leaky, and I just think that it's so cool. I feel like
that
I
really is cool.
Really know
that,
her,
but that wasn't like 10 years ago. That was more like six years ago.
That was the Leaky Lounge.
The Leaky Lounge.
It was like 2007, I think, when we met.
Okay. Yes.
Well, you know, I was just in Brooklyn the other day with just a pack of girls that I met at like LeakyCon 2009 or
really?
On YouTube or something.
That's so
cool. Yeah, at like. The Brooklyn Yule Ball. It was fantastic.
I know, I
you
saw
those
pictures.
You mentioned that, but you didn't...
Potter Puppet Pals were there.
Really?
Yeah, I got to see them.
That's awesome.
That's
so awesome.
But that's kind of...
I think that they are, like, the funniest creation ever made.
They are.
All my other friends were like, why do you want to go see the puppet show? Like, that's like, you know, Harry and the Potter is the band. It's way better. I'm like, you don't understand.
No, it's not.
I need to see these puppets.
That's right. Yeah.
They had more... The Mysterious Ticking Noise had the most play on YouTube with Harry Potter stuff, I think, out of anything.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Yeah. No wonder.
That was pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. When I coached a cheer team, we used to do, like, they sent it to me when it first came out. They were like, Holly, listen to this. And we just laughed at it for a month straight. Aww. Like, it was just our little
That's awesome.
That we had. Yeah. Anyway.
That's great. Okay. Well, thank you so much for getting together and doing this reunion episode, you guys. It's been awesome. It's been fantastic to nerd out Potterness
so
with you guys.
Yeah,
it has been.
It's been great.
So
Thanks
cool.
So much.
Went through a book that's very rich in detail, and we talked about a lot of really impactful, powerful topics, really, and really relived some Potter nostalgia, I guess you could say.
Yeah, we really did.
Yeah. Yeah. So, once again, I'm really sorry that we couldn't do a live show. In the end, I'm actually really happy that we did this regular podcast, because it means that I could, you know, edit out some of the more technical stuff that we encountered during this recording. So, and also, yeah, just tighten up the episode and make it really pristine. Make it really spick.
Thanks,
and
Adam.
And add in...
We appreciate
it. No, thank you. Thank you for coming on and giving us your insights and, you know, being part of this reunion.
Thanks, everybody, for doing
the
reunion.
Thanks, everybody. Yes.
Thanks to
thank
the listeners for still wanting to hear what we have to say.
I know.
That's right.
After, a year and a half or so.
Thank you to Ricky for showing up to the live show.
Yes, thank you, Ricky. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Well, happy holidays to everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Happy holidays.
Happy New
holidays.
Year.
Yeah.
If you celebrate Christmas, Merry Christmas.
Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
You guys are like 2 weeks late.
Happy Festivus.
Festivus.
Just be happy and merry.
Yeah, just be
bright.
Happy.
Yeah.
Spread the
happy,
love.
Happy.
And spend time with your family and your loved ones and
That's
just
right.
enjoy life.
Yeah.
And enjoy turkey dinner unless you're a vegetarian or vegan.
Yeah, just shovel it in.
And enjoy your
in.
Green beans.
Shovel it in.
Just shovel
yeah,
it in.
Yeah, eat your veggies.
Stay
in school.
Yeah.
Stay in school. All right, so I don't know if we've got a Pottermore podcast planned in the future. I hope we do.
We do.
I think it would be an awesome idea.
What is Pottermore?
What is Pottermore? Well, I was
you guys,
like in
the hour that I updated my computer, I read so much crap on Pottermore.
Oh, really?
Good.
That's great.
Great.
Really,
so, you've already done
it
your homework.
Productive.
Yes.
So I'm kind of envisioning this like within the next year or so. I know I say that I said this like when we finished the podcast the first time, but I'm thinking we could do like the Pottermore Pensive podcast.
Yes.
And delve in. I'm thinking we could play like some games because, you know, it's more of an interactive platform, so we could like bring some games into the show.
It's not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore.
Oh, get on Pottermore. Anymore. Get with the times, Adam.
I know. I'm sorry. I have to go back and visit this thing again.
I'm on Pottermore. I'm like a regular. I go on there quite a bit.
You gotta like refigure it out now. I'm still.
You never
sent
me beans though.
It's great.
I have to go back on
it.
And look at it. Yeah,
I love it. I'm a fan.
Anyways, we should definitely do that, and we should figure out how to work this live show so that we can do live shows from now on, because I think that would be really super sweet. Okay, well, I guess that about wraps it up. So, without further ado, Nitwit,
Blubber,
Augment,
Tweak.
All right, take care, you guys. Happy holidays.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
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 Harry Potter.
Oh my god.
I need a little break. I need to run to the loo.
Okay. So that's okay.
I'll be back in a minute.
Okay. I'm going to run to the loo as well.
Okay, cool.
I'll be back.
I might try to convince Chris to go to Starbucks for me too.
Okay. Nice.
Ooh, can you send him out for me too?
I will. Just text me your order and I'm sure he'll be happy to.
Can I have a medium caramel brulee latte?
You mean a grande latte?
I mean, whatever size you give me.
You mean, shut the hell up, Holly. Yes, coming right up.
I mean, I'll expect in the mail in about 4 weeks.
In about, at least 4 to 6 weeks. Literally on the slow boat from China. Literally. There is one of those. Okay, be right back.
Well, guys, everyone else went out for bathroom/coffee breaks. So you are left with me. I am now in charge of the podcast, and I am the sole host, which is perfect because I always thought that I was more of like the Beyonce of this group. I was going to someday break out, find my own way, and now it's happened. So we are now renaming this the Heather Pensive Podcast, and we'll only be talking about things that I like. So up first, we are going to talk about the new musical Hamilton, which is wonderful. It's written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. You may remember him from the White House Poetry Slam in 2009, where he performed the Hamilton mixtape rap with Alex Lacamoire on the piano. Well, that has opened on Broadway this past September, August. Tickets are sold out until next September, and they cost about $1,000. But it's a completely sung-through musical, therefore you can listen to it based on the soundtrack, which came out this September, end of September. It's fantastic. So we'll be reviewing that next, and after that, we are going to try all the different kinds of cheesecake in the world. We're talking like lemon cheesecake, caramel cheesecake, chocolate cheesecake, s'mores cheesecake. We're just going to go through and review all of the cheesecakes and see, like, what it really means to eat them now that the series of cheesecake is finished, and just, like, looking back on it and seeing if we can find any new discoveries or if anything's been shed on the light that we didn't know previously.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey. So, I'm hoping...